You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Best of Flashpoints for the week of February 9th, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we feature an interview with Congresswoman Jackie Speier and author and investigative journalist Greg Palast. Also, a new commentary from Miguel Gavilan Molina. And later, we speak with author and marijuana activist Martin Lee on the passing of a leading pioneer in the medical marijuana movement, Dennis Perrone. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview with Congresswoman Jackie Speier and author and investigative journalist Greg Palast, followed by a new commentary from Miguel Gavilan Molina.
In one moment, we'll be joined by best-selling author, documentarian, and all-around good guy, a regular contributor to this show, Greg Palast. But let's kick this segment off with this interview I ended up doing with Jackie Speier. On Sunday, she showed up at my local Phil's, and we had a chance to chat a bit. This is Dennis Bernstein. I'm actually out in my own neighborhood. Just came out to get some coffee at Phil's, and I ran into Congresswoman Jackie Speier. It's good to see you here. What are you doing here today?
So this is one of our Congress on Your Corners. So we stop in at coffee shops and talk to constituents, hear what's on their mind, and talk to them about the current events and what's troubling our country right now.
Well, let me ask you about, if I could, about sure. Some of those current events. Obviously, we've seen the unraveling of the Trump administration, and we're seeing a real struggle there. We have the dueling memos now. Many people feel, even though they can't stand Trump, and there's a lot of reasons to dislike him, that the Democrats are also a little off. They've got a situation where they have this memo, where you've got opposition research from Clinton helping to fund it. So this is raising questions. Can we trust this investigation as fair, even though they don't trust Trump? So your thoughts on all this? It's a crazy time.
It is a crazy time, but you have to understand the timeline. The FBI and the Department of Justice started looking at the relationship between Russia and the Trump campaign long before the dossier became something that was in their realm of consideration. And the Republican memo puts forth the fact that, in fact, George Papadopoulos was being looked at back in June, and the dossier doesn't become relevant until close to October. Now, that was the last 3 weeks of the campaign.
Yes.
During the last 3 weeks of the campaign, you might remember, it was Jim Comey who came out and said, we're reopening the investigation into Hillary Clinton. If there was any politics going on in that period of time, you could argue that it was the Democrat who was wounded by it, not Donald Trump. Trump is using this because they're closing in on him. There's already two guilty pleas and two indictments of persons very involved in his campaign, his campaign manager, his deputy campaign manager, his national security advisor. So this is, a tactic that he is notorious for. You know, a good defense is a strong offense, and he's got Devin Nunes as his puppet who's pursuing it for him.
Can I ask you, what is your... I know there seems to be a lot of information and evidence about obstruction of justice, but could you tell me your smoking gun information in terms of the collusion charges?
Well, the collusion charges are ones that are more about coordination and conspiracy. Was WikiLeaks the go-to, the intermediary between the Trump campaign and Russia? That's probably where you're going to see the closest link. I mean, we do know that there was efforts put forth to try and connect with WikiLeaks by the Trump campaign. And, the question is, were they successful or not?
So what's the But what's the real evidence of collusion? Even the New York Times has said on several occasions there's no compelling evidence that shows collusion. A lot of terrible things by Donald Trump, from the way he treats women to the, right. Every aspect. But where is the, is this like, we're not going to get him on the collusion, we're going to get him on the cover-up?
Well, that's typically what happens, right? Yeah. That's how Richard Nixon got...
I am interested in what you specifically know about...
Well, first of all, I can't tell you because I serve on the Intelligence Committee. Okay. So some of this is classified information. Yeah. Will the evidence be rock solid, or will it be circumstantial? I mean, a lot depends on how successful the committee is and how successful Bob Mueller is. I mean, frankly, the committee is so fractured now, and the inability of Democrats to have witnesses come forward to testify because the majority won't allow it really ties the hands of the committee in doing a thorough investigation. We've really got to rely on Mueller, and we'll have to wait and see what he comes up with.
Okay, now a big question about this. A lot of people in this state who are terrified in terms of the immigration crackdowns. I saw that the Senate Pro Tem talked about he himself could get arrested for the stance that he's taking in terms of sanctuary. Your thoughts on this? I mean, because there are a lot of frightened people in this state now.
You know, my thoughts are, elections have consequences, and it's important for us to protect the rule of law, but also, protect individuals from, being taken in a police state. So I think that we're just going to have to rein in Homeland Security and Border Patrol and ICE, but we can't do that until we regain the majority in the House.
So what's the message? I mean, we're standing here, outside the Excelsior. I'm sure within, a quarter mile here, there's a lot of frightened people who aren't sure what to do. People who perhaps do the hardest work, who make sure we have beautiful food on the table, so on and so forth. What's the message to them?
Well, the message to them is have faith that the system will overcome this xenophobia that exists in the Republican Party and that is being promoted by the president. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the time. And again, that was Congresswoman Jackie Speier speaking to her. I was speaking to her in my own neighborhood in the Excelsior in San Francisco, where she was doing some community work. And she was gracious enough to take a few minutes out to talk to us. And we're going to continue the discussion of what's really going on in the world of journalism and this Trump frenzy, where it doesn't matter. Collusion, whatever, we hate him so much, we don't care if it's real or not. Greg Palast, you want to jump in here? You heard that interview. Your thoughts on the fact that there is no evidence on collusion. Your response.
Yeah, it's secret because you don't got nothing. Here's, look, my dear progressive, fellow progressive. Okay, do we hate Donald Trump so much that we're willing to join him in throwing our civil liberties into his bonfire? Here's the problem. The Nunes memo, which the Democrats and MSDNC wanted to ride, it did reveal really disturbing FBI perjury about the FBI agents lying to the secret court, these black-robed inquisitors called the FISA court. Ed Snowden warned us about this secretive court that brings down the entire surveillance state on U.S. citizens. We can't be applauding this no matter what we feel about Trump. What the evidence that they used was a file of sludge called the Steele dossier, which was, and they didn't reveal, according to Nunes, that it was paid for by Hillary Clinton. Nunes himself is concealing something even more important. It was originally created by the Republican billionaire Paul Singer, which we've discussed, the guy known as the Vulture. This is typical of Singer. He creates these files. The Steele dossier, by the way, there's a Palace dossier, too. He's created one on me. He's created one on world leaders that he doesn't like. And he uses this for destroying people's reputation. And here they're using this crud as evidence before a secret court that should be shut down to bring down the weight of the surveillance state on this on Carter Page and who knows whom else. We shouldn't be applauding this stuff. Ed Snowden tried to expose this garbage from this court and how the FBI is misusing it. We can't be applauding this.
Now, we know that the Clinton machine made many enemies during the campaign in terms of the way they really brutalized publicly and privately and undermined the campaign of Bernie Sanders. We know that there were a number of disgruntled Bernie Sanders people who finally went to work with Clinton. And once they got inside, they realized that the Clinton machine was destruction. And, so we never really heard the content of the emails.
Let me get to where you're going, I think, which is that, okay, you just had your congresswoman accuse WikiLeaks, right, which brought us the real words of Chelsea Manning, told us the truth about what was going on in our government. What she's complaining about, she's saying WikiLeaks is the conduit. This is a hell of an accusation without a shred, not one jot of evidence. She's saying that WikiLeaks, that these are Russian agents, and Julian Assange is a Russian agent without a single shred of evidence, zero, nothing. And what's your evidence? Oh, well, they had files from the Democratic National Committee, okay? And obviously, that has to be from a Russian hacker, okay? But what you're implying is probably the real source. In fact, what Julian Assange has said, you got a disgruntled, someone at the DNC was disgruntled who was supporting Bernie Sanders and saw these memos in which they were conspiring to break the law, commit felony crimes to undermine the Sanders campaign and promote Hillary Clinton. What she is saying is that you're a Russian agent because she showed us these are not, by the way, Putin did not write the DNC memos, and WikiLeaks didn't write the DNC memos. They're written by the DNC leadership on ways to illegally screw Bernie Sanders, the felony crime, using money that was meant for the party, used for a candidate. That's a crime, okay? And what she's saying is, if you are telling the American people the truth, you are a Russian agent. And when a Democrat starts talking like that, using that McCarthyite language, I want to vomit. We cannot support this type of McCarthyite attacks. What she's saying is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks told us the truth. How dare they tell us the truth about the Democratic Party? I'm sorry, I may not like, is Donald Trump a nuclearized narcissist and a bloviating bigot? Yes. Does that mean that we should now destroy the United States Constitution and start hauling people in on McCarthyite hearings because they're telling us the truth? I'm sorry. I do not want this FISA court should be shut down right now, okay? And the FBI should stop using perjury to get warrants to surveil people. Sorry, I can't go along with that.
Well, I tell you, a lot of people in the corporate press can go along with it. They love the story. They're making money hand over fist on the story. And now they're hiring former high-level and heads of the CIA and the NSA. They're now becoming commentators for MSNBC, where you've got journalists celebrating folks who participated in overthrowing governments, who helped to create wars of mass murder.
And by the way, I want to thank KPFA. I'm not the only person that's dissenting from saying that the Nunes memo actually did show very disturbing things. CIA whistleblower, ex-CIA man, Mel Goodman, he also said this is a serious case of intelligence agency misconduct, perjuring themselves before judges to get warrants for surveillance against American citizens. And that was only on KPFA. Thank you very much. Okay. On Pacifica. Now, the other problem in the Nunes memo, and you're bringing this up, this is very important, is that they brought up the texting between two FBI agents who are having an affair. It's really serious stuff that was revealed in those texts, including the fact that, one, a guy named Peter Strzok, okay, wrote memos saying his job was to protect the nation from Donald Trump. Now, that may be a worthy cause, but you don't use the power of the FBI to do it. And how did he use his power? He did use it, okay? Your congressman said that, Comey came out and attacked and said that he was reopening the investigation of Hillary Clinton. Again, she's complaining that he was telling the truth. But I got to tell you something else. Comey said that Hillary Clinton, in using her own private email server instead of a secured email server, was extremely careless, was the term he used, extremely careless. Now that sounds like she's being a bad girl. The original phrase that Comey had written was not extremely careless. He wrote grossly negligent. Grossly negligent in the handling of classified information is a crime. And this guy, Peter Strzok, who wants to protect us from Donald Trump, got Comey to change the language. If you don't find that disturbing, I do. Yes? And so, in other words, he was hoping that by softening the language, it wouldn't hit Hillary so hard when it went out. I'm sorry, the FBI is not here to campaign for Hillary, to protect us against Trump. You want to impeach Trump? Let's do it on the evidence. Let's not have the FBI and the CIA act as hit squads against a sitting president, no matter how odious he is. We go along with that, and our civil liberties are history.
And now I'm thinking about, do you remember, does the name Rosemary Wood ring a bell for you? She was the secretary who was blamed for Nixon's 18-and-a-half-minute gap. Now, there's a big gap. It seems like the FBI and misplaced a few hundred crucial, relevant memos, but we're being told that's irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, for example, if you read, I think you should read the texting between the FBI agent Strzok and a woman named Paige.
She was a Justice Department. She was actually a Justice Department attorney working with the FBI.
That's right, Justice Department attorney. They're having an affair. That's okay. That's their personal business. But what was revealed, for example, is that the FBI failed to note and make public the fact that there was a little C on several of the emails that Hillary had in her private server. C stands for classified. That's not minor stuff. Remember, she was saying she's doing a wedding announcement and her mother's funeral preparations and things like that. And, well, not, you know, I'm sorry. Wedding invites don't have a classified marker on them. So they were doing their best to protect Hillary Clinton. The idea that David Comey was out to get Hillary Clinton is insane, okay? And you know, I'm not, by the way, Comey was, I believe, manipulated by these other agents, and that's serious stuff, too. You know, Mueller and Comey are actually, you know, the FBI doesn't have a stellar record of directors who protect our civil liberties. Let's remember Mr. Hoover, right? But Mueller and Comey were the guys who ran to the bedside of John Ashcroft, what they thought was his deathbed, to stop Deputy Attorney General Gonzalez from getting Ashcroft to sign papers that would allow torture at Guantanamo. These are good guys. But you have to understand that within these agencies, there's very disturbing material. Nunes has made this public, and I don't think we should take it lightly. This is serious stuff.
It's amazing, and it is worrisome because it does seem like the liberals have turned into warmongers who are pushing for it's sort of by any means necessary. If we need to strike up the Cold War, if we need to threaten nuclear war, if we need to, whatever we need to do to make Russia the boogeyman Hillary Clinton lost the election. And we want to get rid of Donald Trump. This is walking a tightrope.
It's very serious stuff. And by the way, I want to point out another very serious, damaging, and terrible thing. You know, the Democrats keep pointing to this a joint statement of our intelligence agencies, like 16 intelligence agencies, which supposedly discuss collusion.
17. 17. Yeah, but it's not 17 anyway.
Sorry, I forgot.
If you're going to get their lie right. Anyway,
so they were all there to tell us about how Russia was interfering in our elections, which is true, fine. But what was their evidence? I haven't heard anyone quote the report, but I will quote it to you now, okay? Half of the report, half of it, was about RTTV, and that was supposedly the Russian cat's paw to elect Hillary Clinton. Now, if anyone knows RTTV, that's Sean Stone, that's Greg Palast, that's Abby Martin, that's Tom Hartman. And if any of those people, are, including me, are supposedly the pro-Trump voices, We're paying $1 trillion to these agencies to tell us that Greg Palast was the pro-Trump mouthpiece? I don't think so. And here's some of the other things it said, and this is very dangerous. Listen to this, Dennis. This is from the report. It said that RT is messaging Russian interests, because they quote that they have run reports featuring, quote, the anti-fracking movement and the dangers of fracking to the environment and health.
Wow.
And they said that that's Russian messaging.
Wow.
Okay. And now, why is that dangerous? It's laughable. It's stupid. But here's why it's dangerous. Because it's basically saying, if you're in the anti-fracking movement, you are a messenger of Russia. That you're only taking the anti-fracking position because you are serving, and this is another quote from them, and the anti-fracking movement serving Russian interests. That's how they knew that RT was part of the Trump campaign, because the anti now this may sound completely insane to you, but this is in the report. You got to read this report, okay? It also said, believe it or not, that they said that they featured something called the Occupy Wall Street movement on RT, and which took the position that America is not a real democracy, but is tainted by corporate interests and money. That is, it said, was a message of the Russian government. A message of the Russian government that this is that we have a corporate corruption of our democracy. I thought it was a Bernie Sanders message, but I guess obviously he's a Russian. He must be a Russian spy too. This is dangerous stuff, Dennis, and the Democratic Party is leading the charge.
All right, we have 30 seconds left. What is the antidote?
The antidote.
Truth telling.
Go see my film. It's on Amazon now. It's the best democracy money can buy. But that's the whole thing. You got to expose this stuff. The truth is our only antidote. And unfortunately, it ain't going to come from the Democratic Party. That was a very disappointing, ugly and McCarthyite statement by your congresswoman. And I'm sorry. And I'm sorry that it comes from the mouth of a Democrat.
Well, me too. I was hoping for a little bit more, but I do appreciate that she took the time to speak with us and to give us her perspective, because it's very important for people to understand really the details of the problems with this story, what the officials are saying, and how we need to counteract it. Greg Palast, as always, you can check more of his work at gregpalast.com. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. This is the film that he has revised and made really a fight-back tool for the upcoming 2018 elections and the next presidential run. We're going to be talking about all this when we strike up our election crimes bulletin again. Greg Palast, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dennis, for the opportunity.
Bye. All right, and you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, now, once again, there is the possibility of a shutdown. The Dreamers are the political football being thrown back and forth between the president and Congress. Last time, the Democrats caved. They signed on for a short-term agreement to fund the country. The battle is back. The deadline is approaching. And Trump says he's screw the Dreamers. If, you know, I'm looking forward to a shutdown if the Democrats will not bend over on the Dreamers and do exactly what I want. That's what that's about. Miguel Gavilán Molina is our senior producer here at Flashpoints. Miguel knows a lot about this struggle. He started, as he says, in the fields of toil as a farm worker, fought his way up, became the co-founder of the first bilingual radio station in this country, and has been with us working on this issue of the Dreamers, on the rights of the undocumented, which he has experienced in terms of the crackdown and the racism firsthand. Here is Miguel Gavilán Molina.
Eaters, beaners, go back home. All the way.
Alerta. This is Miguel Gavilán Molina for Flashpoints. The situation for Dreamers is at a critical stage with their lives on the line. With every tick of the clock and every passing day, another 200 youths lose their hopes and dreams and a future denied, finding themselves at risk of deportation in the latest attempt by federal authorities at ethnic cleansing. More than 17,000 have already lost their protective status, living in constant terror of being targeted, profiled, detained, and forced against their will to leave the only country they have always called home. Last month, the supremacist White House, led by anti-immigrant basher Stephen Miller, leaked news of a new proposal on immigration they plan to announce. The Los Angeles Times said it like it is when they stated, "This isn't an immigration plan, it's a ransom note." You may ask, who is the ransom note for? I'll tell you, the Dreamers. Held hostage by a racist, inhumane, insensitive White House administration. The plan is part of a scheme to exploit a crisis crafted by the White House and Miller when the DACA program was terminated last September, placing some 800,000 young people, Dreamers, at risk of deportation. This new proposal holds these human beings hostage in exchange for slashing legal family immigration and supplying billions of tax dollars to build an anti-human wall and dramatically increasing deportation. This is the latest quote from the president a day ago. "I'd love to see a shutdown if demos don't meet immigration demands." Recent polls show 87% of the American people support a real, comprehensive, clean, and just solution for these young people. While the White House caters to its white supremacist base, we must move from expressions of disgust and outrage to demands for action from our local, state, and national representatives. We must reach out beyond our comfort zones, connect, organize, build new alliances outside of our cultural, social realities, and solidify our common ground with solidarity and direct action. We must forge new leadership in the resistance, push, and fight back to protect the future and dreams of these young people. Now, you need to call your local elected official senators and tell them not to let the supremacist White House use the vulnerability of the Dreamers to railroad this country into betraying who we are as a people and as a nation. We have to get the message through loud and clear before the Senate reconvenes on this issue, which will be soon. Unless you're Native American, this nation was built on genocide and immigration. Aho.
If you're on the borderline, who do they stop you in the back of the bus? They can't. They don't bother about that.
Away, Texas and began to expand. The book was like to say, remember the Alamo. They don't want to know who I am, but I'll let them know. I'm the M-E-X-I-C-A-N. So hit the ground and prepare for the spray. Take what I got, I'm going to take it right back. To get invasion of millions to push the border back.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of February 9th, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview with author and marijuana activist Martin Lee on the passing of a leading pioneer in the medical marijuana movement, Dennis Perron.
This is Dennis Bernstein. I'm in Santa Rosa by the railroad tracks and the Arlene Francis Center, a cultural center here in this boom town in Northern California. I'm with Martin Lee. Martin Lee is a longtime journalist, author of Smoke Signals, and the director of Project CBD. We're going to talk about that later, what that is and what that means. Martin Lee, it's good to talk to you again, but it's a sad moment that brings us together as well.
Yeah, this Robert Perry, Bob Perry, the great journalist, one of the great journalists of our time, passed away not long ago. And you know, something about his passing at this moment, you know, Trump was celebrating his first year in office, and what Bob was doing so courageously as a journalist, reporting on the scandals around Trump, and almost singularly leading the way of refusing to bend to propaganda on either side, the Republicans, Democrats, and a voice so sorely needed now. We're going to really, really miss him.
What, for you, what stands out in terms of Bob Perry and his journalism? I know that you monitor the Consortium News, and you yourself are a fantastic journalist as well, so you have that inside view. Talk to us about that.
Well, Bob, in some ways, is unparalleled, or very, very few, I would put in his category, Seymour Hersh, I.F. Stone, George Seldes. He really does rank with the greats. And to the extent, I think there was some commentary after he died, someone made a very perceptive comment, to the extent that he wasn't well known in this country, almost like a household name, really speaks to how neutered and thin our political culture has become, how vapid. Yeah, he's just going to be so difficult. He's irreplaceable. Well, he in an unrelenting sort of way, broke scandal after scandal, major story after major story. Wherever he turned and you know, shined the light of his interest, what he would dig up, it was just so important to know. And it highlight the perilousness of our times where what he did was so, so important given how things have been devolving culturally and politically now over the last several decades in the United States.
Yeah, well, we're going to miss Bob Perry. The Consortium News continues. And then, you know, in terms of transitioning to talking about marijuana and the New World Order here in California, we lost a great, a visionary in the movement for safe, accessible marijuana, and that's Dennis Perone. You want to talk about that? Remind people don't know who he is either.
Well, within the cannabis community, Dennis is well known. He is really a hero. I mean, you can. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the medical marijuana phenomenon, as a social phenomenon, as actually lived out phenomenon in California and elsewhere, is built on his shoulders. He was the single most important character in that story of the emergence of medical marijuana as a political and social phenomenon in the United States. There's nobody more important than him in that respect. That he should pass the same day as Bob Perry really just was like a double hit. Dennis really was a visionary. He saw the future before anybody else.
He's courageous.
He understood, you know, back several years before the passage of Proposition 215, which legalized marijuana for therapeutic use in California, several years that was the way to go, that was the way to break the logjam of the drug war. And I think the other side, the drug warriors, understood, you know, when they lost California, when they lost medical marijuana, it was the beginning of the end, in a sense. Sure, there's plenty of resistance, but Dennis found the formula to take this whole thing down, and it's remarkable. And you know, Dennis, who was a very lovable character, in my opinion. I know sometimes people found him very difficult to work with because he was impulsive, and you know, when he wanted to give to a cause, when he was running the San Francisco Cannabis Bars Club in San Francisco before it was legalized,
right?
This is a direct action, civil disobedience. If he felt it was important to support a cause, he'd put his hand in a bag of money and just give it. You know, that's just the way he was. But he was not a political, ideological, intellectual. He wasn't studying, you know, all the theories of social change. He wasn't. He wasn't a professional thinker in that way, and yet what he did as an activist went so far beyond anyone could have theorized. You know, he was a doer in a profound sense, and what he did changed the world, really changed the world. It has changed California and ultimately the world with respect to marijuana. It's you can't overstate his importance.
He changed the world, and luckily, even though we lost him, he got a
a chance to see that it really was a changing world, that he had made a difference.
I think he felt very ambiguous about legalization, at least the way it was playing out. You know, Dennis was really grassroots. I mean, you know, dirt under the fingernails, yes. Grassroots. And I think he would have had real mixed feelings about, you know, the way the big business interests were moving in and so forth to legalization, which has been a mixed blessing. But, you know, I still feel it an important step to have taken, although I'm not even sure Dennis would have voted for Proposition 64. Just on principle in a certain way as a kind of a very radical anarchist, but not even a left-wing guy, just a doer. You know, that's right. He was a remarkable human being.
All right. Let's talk about the rollout in California. This is an exciting moment, but many people, including Dennis, I'm sure, it was a troubling moment because there's a lot at play. There are a lot of problems with the rollout, and it may be legal, Marnie, but it may not be accessible.
Well, you're going to have to pay more for it now. That's if you're playing the legitimate route. In some sense, a fascinating moment if you could step back, but also a very, very difficult one for a lot of people. I mean, we just published the first part of a lengthy three-part report on our website on projectcbd.org. And we're calling it Green Rush Blues. The Green Rush was sort of the economic seeing gold and then our buds kind of thing, and which was a very, you know, strong impulse. You know, the impetus for legalizing cannabis, you know, initially was about social justice, about keeping people out of jail, about not taking away a tool that the police and elites can use to disproportionately target people of color, particularly young people. And so that was the motivating force. It was very noble, very altruistic. But in recent years, that energy, while it's still there, has been supplanted to some degree, overtaken to some degree by business interests, by seeing dollar signs in the cannabis world, and that's just the reality. The way legalization is playing out thus far, let's just say it's a work in progress at best, and the regulations, the way that the officials in California have promulgated them, ultimately, they're going to have to change because. There's really two key objectives, as I understand it, from the point of view of the regulators. They wanted to curtail illicit sales, bring them this multi-billion-dollar force, this shadowy underground economy, into to sort of embed it in the legitimate economy, so-called, in California. But the second key objective was to minimize the really horrific environmental damage that's been inflicted in Northern California, particularly in, you know, these ancient forests that people fought so hard to protect going back to the 1970s and 80s in particular. I know you were involved in covering that period. But the idea is if you can bring people into the light of day, you monitor the grow sites, make sure that they're playing by the green rules and not, you know, cutting into the hills and removing trees when they shouldn't and leaving pesticides and then rodent killers that are extremely toxic and diverting the water and ruining the streams and basically poisoning the watershed. And that is happening to a large degree. You know, I'm a very much of a pro-cannabis person, as you know, but I'm also a green. And there are some bad actors out there and within the growing world. Not everybody, by any means. In fact, there's also a powerful counterforce to that, organic growers, small farmers, and outdoor growers, and so forth. And that's been more the tradition in the Emerald Triangle, the cannabis breadbasket in Northern California. But the way the rules are coming down... it's not like it's intentional. They want it to screw up. But the way the rules are playing out, it could almost guarantee the persistence of a black market, which will then guarantee the continuation of this terrible environmental abuse that's going on. Because if you can't regulate what's happening, it gives rise to these sort of abuses. So, you know, how this is going to play out is... it's going to be very, very interesting. It's such an unusual and unique situation because this is not like Colorado. This is not like, you know, Washington, D.C., rolling out legal cannabis. You're talking about California, the fifth largest economy in the world. The biggest, it's a source nation is what it was considered. Northern California was considered by the DEA a source nation for illegal drugs. That's the way they looked at it, almost like a foreign country that they would go in. And they did have a military, well, back in the 80s and even persisting. The so-called black helicopters and all that stuff. There was a paramilitary invasion that would happen every harvest season in Northern California. That's not going on in the same way now, but things are shifting somewhat. But still, one of the points that Angela Baca, who wrote this excellent series for Project CBD, she pointed out that, you know, eradication funds from the federal government to cut down marijuana plants in the Emerald Triangle, that money is still flowing, and those operations are still happening, even though we're legal, supposedly.
Really? Eradication is ongoing now?
Oh, definitely. You're looking to eradicate illegal grows. You're looking to deal with, not just simply eradicate these environmentally damaging grows, but to you have to clean up this stuff. You can't have this kind of toxic chemicals that leak into the watershed and really a lot of problems. So I think there's a legitimate role to play on the part of state agencies, in terms of environment. But, the drug war dies hard. The drug warriors don't give up so easy. And there's a lot of loopholes in this situation. Just because it's legal in California, cannabis, it doesn't mean that law enforcement, even in California, suddenly the game's over for them. No, they're going to be very busy eventually, if not, maybe not right away during this initial transition, but, you know, going after the illegal, those that are operating continually now with the black market. And I think the way the rules have been set up, because the taxes are so high, the costs of coming into compliance are so convoluted and also just simply high financially, that it will push a lot of the growers, particularly the smaller growers, in a situation where they'll stay in the black market. And you look at Humboldt, they estimate of the
Humboldt County.
Yeah, 8,000 growers in a certain area, only 2,000 have come forward. Roughly, those aren't the exact numbers that are. But, you know, that means most are staying in the black market game. Why? Well, if you can grow and get your stuff out of state, and most of what's grown in California is consumed out of state, it's estimated $20 billion worth of cannabis is grown in California. About $15 billion of that is ending up all over the country, outside of its borders. And that's not supposed to happen. You have this just impossible situation if you're a small grower or any kind of grower. If you can make more money by meeting this insatiable demand for cannabis all around the country, on the one hand, there's that. On the other side of it is federal law, which is still, it's prohibited. It's still Schedule I. This is still a banned substance. Well, that's an unbearable kind of tension, and that's where California is sitting in the middle of today. Because the reality is, legalization or no legalization, a lot of the cannabis is going to continue to go outside California because people want it, because the product is good, it's the best around. And you have a long tradition now, several decades, of California cannabis is beloved by millions throughout the country. So.
All right, let's just to be specific so people understand who aren't familiar with the system of dispensaries and what the prices were, what they are now. Clearly, given the new impositions in terms of, you know, the requirements from the state, it has, increased the price almost by one-third of all the things that you... Yeah. So most people can't afford that.
Well, you know, it depends what you're looking at. But, yes, I've heard in a dispensary, if they're selling what they call a pre-roll, they change a pre-roll joint, nice, big, fat, not exactly a cigar, but it could get there if you have a big pre-roll. But, you know, the smaller ones would go for about $10 in a dispensary. typically. Now they're going for 13. And that's without the dispensary making any more money on the deal, just to maintain what was going on before. So, yeah, the taxes are incredible. It's not that I'm ideologically opposed to taxes, but the whole point is a balance. You don't want to underregulate, which was the situation before in California with medical marijuana. Right. You don't want to overregulate. You need a balance. I mean, if you think about the way cannabis works physiologically in the human brain and body, it's all about balance. It's about affecting physiology in a way that brings about balance. And, you know, so that to me is a good model. If that's what it's about when we're talking about cannabis as a medicine or just as something one would consume, or whether it's altering consciousness or not, you know, you project that on a social level. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with regulations, in my opinion. Some people, particularly kind of more the libertarian right, you know, see ipso facto, the regulation, just the concept is bad. No, that's without regulation, you die. Without regulation, that's cancer. When you're not, without regulation, you starve to death. I mean, that's just part of the way the world, you know, everything functions, from microcosm to the macrocosm. And you got to get that one right. And I don't think the regulators have gotten it right the first time around. And they're going to have to adjust. And I think ultimately they will. But the pattern in other states where cannabis has been legalized for adult use as well as medical use, states like Oregon, Washington, Colorado, while the taxes initially were very high because they were meeting certain projections to fill the state coffers, the response in terms of the amount consumed was so much higher than they anticipated, they could actually bring the taxes down and still make more than they thought they would in terms of, you know, again, filling the state coffers with, gold, with Acapulco gold. I wish that strain was
still around. Let me just jump in here.
I think California will have to make that adjustment.
My observation of the various dispensaries and talking with a bunch of people is they're doing pretty well. They have been doing pretty well. But here's a question that was raised to me. If there's a 25% tax, so what you buy is going to go up 25%.
It will go more, actually.
Or more than that. Shouldn't the dispensary split the difference with the clients, particularly in a medicinal context?
Well, the taxing is happening at every level of the production.
Right.
Without answering your question directly, I'll show you some of the problems here. If you tax as the regulations do, by plant numbers, every plant gets taxed a certain amount. Okay, and if you're a grower, you're going to want that plant to produce as much as possible because you're going to pay the same amount in tax anyway. So if you have a little plant or a big plant. If you can grow an 8-pounder versus a 2-pounder, or what, you know, it's much better for you. Well, what makes plants grow bigger? Well, if you can grow really well outdoors, organically in sunlight, and know the right things, yeah, you can grow a real big plant. But you know, a lot of these growers nowadays don't have even a lot of good growing experience. What are they going to use? Hormone boosters, the crap that's sold in these hydroponic stores to make the plants artificially bigger. You know, it's like putting it's just basically bloating these plants with these chemicals. Well, that's what the tax structure is incentivizing. And one of the guiding lights in all this was supposed to be mitigate environmental damage. So the tax structure is having the opposite effect. In fact, one of the things we point out as a result of some great work done by activists in the Emerald Triangle, led by Christian Nevedal and her organization there, they basically crunched the numbers and showed how the tax burden was disproportionately targeting outdoor small farmers growing in sunlight. Now, that's the least carbon footprint when you grow from the sun. Right. It was basically the tax structure was incentivizing large-scale indoor grows. That's the opposite of green. You know, so they're going to have to figure this out and realize what they've done. Maybe they meant to, whatever their intentions, it's not going according to what it's supposed to be. And, yeah, in terms of, the taxes get, you get hit all along the way. The growers get taxed. Then it's sold to a producer that wants to make oil and make products, make edibles. That's then taxed. And then it goes to a distributor because a producer can't go right to a dispensary. Then that transition gets taxed. And then by the time it gets to the dispensary, you've had four layers of taxes. And then there's sometimes in some counties an extra county tax like there is in Mendocino. That's on top of everything else. And an excise tax. So you're then paying tax on your taxes. It's not like the original thing was, let's say, $100. You know, no, you're being taxed every time you're taxed that amount. That's how crazy it is. So, you know, I think it's a bit of a misconception to assume all dispensaries are, you know, they're just money mills. There some done very, very well. You would think that the price, things are, you know, they tend to double the price of what they pay for things, from what I understand. Dispensaries do.
Yeah, the price.
Well, at least the way it used to be.
Right.
But, you know, they're also paying for lawyers and security guards and, you know, paying for a lot of nonsense that ordinary business shouldn't have to pay for. Not that lawyers don't deal with ordinary businesses, but you get the point. So I don't want to defend the practices of dispensaries because I think greed is something, unfortunately, that cannabis doesn't seem to cure very well. It can help a lot of conditions, but I think greed and malice doesn't seem to necessarily be one, for everybody at least. So, yeah, no, but there are problems across the board. I know that a lot of dispensaries that exist in California will shut down because they can't go, for one reason or another, they can't become compliant or they choose not to be. There's a lot of new regulations for dispensaries now. I don't want to make it feel like, you know, oh, poor dispensaries, but it's a big shakeup.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints. This is Dennis Bernstein. I was speaking with Martin Lee, author of Smoke Signals. He's the director of Project CBD and a good friend of this show. And we're talking about the rollout of the commercial and the recreational marijuana industry in California, which came into being on January 1st. There's a lot going on this front. Marty, I just want to take a minute to, I always want to check in with you in terms of the CBD front, in terms of the research, any new information, any breakthroughs, anything that is newsworthy in the context of this industry.
You know, if you follow the science, every week there's something, but it's something that might be a significant more to other scientists than anybody else. But it's a very dynamic field of research now. The cannabinoid science, I would say on average, is maybe 50 new articles, 50, in peer-reviewed scientific journals around the world that are dealing in some way with cannabinoids, cannabis, the internal endocannabinoid system that mediates the effects of these things. It's a very... What's recent? There was just an interesting report, not about CBD per se, but in terms of cannabinoids, one that came out about THC showing in animal studies that had a protective effect against the cognitive deficits. Usually, in terms of the drug war, the way it's been framed, cannabis will induce cognitive deficits. You won't remember as well. You'll be less alert, less quick to respond. You shouldn't drive. You know, all this kind of stuff. Well, here is a study that showed chronic use or chronic low doses of THC and did just the opposite of that. Yes, actually, it was protective against cognitive deficit in mice. Now, it's an interesting study, but keep in mind, it's just one compound, not the whole plant. You know, there's hundreds of compounds in the whole plant. And it was an animal study, not a human study. You know, so we don't know what that means. But it's just interesting that the implications, if you would, run counter to the the ongoing prejudices that still continue and the stigma that still attaches to cannabis, particularly to THC. See, CBD is the good guy now. THC is still kind of the bad guy in terms of the way the...
Because it makes you feel bad.
Well, yeah, and change... I don't know why. It is. It's the horrible cannabinoid still to some. You look at these states that are just legalizing only CBD or the industrial hemp's now cool, I guess, because it doesn't have much THC. And THC is still the bad guy in some quarters. And that's, I think, one of the powerful take-home messages of the scientific research is that that's a false framework, that you shouldn't frame it in terms of a good guy cannabinoid versus a bad guy cannabinoid, CBD versus THC, that actually they work together, they synergize, they have an additive effect for pain killing and for many other things when both are present in the plant or in a particular product. So that comes through, really strong. Just there's so many things. You can get very, very into the weeds on this, but I'm finding it quite fascinating.
And of course... that brings us to important information regarding criminalization, federal government versus the state government. Clearly, this kind of research would be much further along if there weren't so many legal restraints to being able to do it. That's part of this new movement, and we're dealing also with, how do we bring relief to the folks who suffered, who are in jail, who are getting out of jail. So this is the other part of that. This is the other side of that.
Well, it was great to see that in California, there's a policy now unfolding where people having their records erased in terms of cannabis crimes.
Big announcement from the district attorney of San Francisco that it's thousands.
I hope that's statewide, but certainly it's happening in various places in California. And that's exactly what should happen. One of the things, one of the positives of legalization, which again has been a mixed bag. But one thing I just wanted to stress quickly, Dennis, is that when we talk about research, yes, the federal government clearly has thwarted and continues to thwart research into cannabis, meaning the plant, the herb, the actual green material. Yeah. Very difficult to access cannabis to do research if you're a scientist today in the United States. But there's lots of research with individual molecules in a laboratory on rat brains, that is very, very... very rich and dynamic. We also have to realize that's not just in the United States, but there's research going on all over the world and in other countries, and at least in some other countries, there's much greater leniency and more openness to seriously exploring the medical implications of cannabis. Israel, for example, there's some good things that have happened there in that regard, but not just in Israel. Two of the countries that are, to my mind, doing some of the most interesting research, Iran and China. In terms of research into cannabinoid system in China, they're doing fascinating research into how acupuncture's effects are mediated by the same receptors that THC bings and turns on. The pain-killing effects of acupuncture, at least certain aspects of that are mediated. It's not that maybe is not the only thing going on, but that's documented in military academies in China are doing this research. Fascinating that this is going on. And Iran, too. When you think about what Trump would love to bomb that country to smithereens, and oh, my God. Again, we need Bob Parry to expose the nonsense around this. But Iran, fascinating research is going on there into cannabis and other herbs and spices. Again, how they work through similar channels and things. It's an ever-widening horizon, I find, and one that's utterly fascinating.
All right, well, we're going to leave it right there. That's Martin Lee. He's author of Smoke Signals. He's the editor at Project and director at Project CBD. You can check that out. And then there's this new piece. What's it called?
Well, it's Green Rush Blues. The first part of that was just published. It's a three-part series. It should all be available soon.
On
ProjectCBD.org, written by Angela Baca, who I think you should talk to her. She really did some great digging.
Well, we're going to get in touch with her. It's great always to be in touch with you, Martin. This is Dennis Bernstein in Santa Rosa. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. The mission is crazy, and the captain is crazy, and the ship is going to go down, unless the crew mutinies. That's Moby Dick, and that's also America Today, explains Chris Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. We've just observed the 50th anniversary of that profoundly important event, the Beatles appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show. I assume it was a profoundly important event. That's because at my supermarket, half the magazines by the checkout had it all over their covers. That's America for you. The people who control popular culture love anniversaries with round numbers. A year ago, only 16 people in the entire country gave even a passing thought to the Beatles appearing on Ed Sullivan. February 2014, and it's on the cover of Guns and Ammo. Well, practically. Later this year, expect a deluge of articles on the 100th anniversary of World War I. That was an extravaganza every bit as exciting as the Beatles' appearance on Ed Sullivan, and with a bigger budget, too. Come November, we'll be up to here in World War I nostalgia. So we love to remember things on their round anniversaries, and then forget them again 2 weeks later. Which made me wonder what the anniversary involving Herman Melville was. The 19th century American writer, not much admired in his own day, today considered one of the greats. Everywhere I turn, I've been seeing references to Melville or to his novel Moby Dick. Last October, Chris Hedges gave a lecture at Moravian College. He talked at length about Moby Dick. Later, the radio program Unwelcome Guests broadcast that speech. Virtual renderings included snippets from it in its latest audio collage. We played some of that last week. I pick up the January 27th issue of The Nation magazine, and there's the cover and two articles on Reading Melville in Post-9/11 America. But there's no nice round anniversary to mark, not Melville's birth or death, or the publication of Moby Dick, nothing. Maybe it's just that the plot of Moby Dick is so symbolic of America today. You have a leader, that's Captain Ahab, who seems sane enough on a day-to-day basis, but who is dedicating his life and his ship to pursuing an insane goal. That is, tracking down and killing a particular giant whale. In the end, he destroys himself and his ship and almost everyone on board. Okay, Ahab is corporate capitalism, pursuing the insane goals of selling and burning more fossil fuels, destroying the Bill of Rights, destroying American manufacturing, ignoring catastrophic climate change, ruling the world by military force, and valuing absolutely nothing except money profit. How insane do you have to be before people start saying, "That's insane"? I confess, I've never been able to finish Moby Dick. You might like it. Chris Hedges did. And Chris Hedges we shall hear now. Some of the talk he gave last October. It's called The Myth of Human Progress and the Collapse of Complex Civilizations. It's about the need to rebel. The crew of Ahab's ship, the Pequod, should have rebelled, should have mutinied, Hedges says. They failed to rebel, and they were destroyed. And for Hedges, Moby Dick is a story about us today. Here is my condensed version of that talk.
Perhaps the most prescient portrait of the American character and our ultimate fate as a species is found in Herman Melville's Moby Dick. He is our foremost oracle, what William Shakespeare was to Elizabethan England, or Fyodor Dostoevsky was to Tsarist Russia. In Moby Dick, our country is given shape in the form of the ship, the Pequod, named after the Pequot Indian tribe exterminated in 1638 by the Puritans and their Native American allies. The ship's 30-man crew, there were 30 states in the Union when Melville wrote the novel, is a mixture of races and creeds. The object of the hunt is a massive white whale, Moby Dick, which in a previous encounter maimed the ship's captain, Ahab, by dismembering one of his legs. The maniacal quest, much like that of a civilization, dependent on fossil fuel and the profits of global speculators, assures the Pequod's destruction. And those on the ship, on some level, know they are doomed, just as many of us know that our civilization and our ecosystem cannot stand the continued assault by corporate capitalism. But when a man suspects any wrong, it sometimes happens that if he be already involved in the matter, he insensibly strives to cover up his suspicions from himself, Ishmael says in Moby Dick. And much this way it was with me. I said nothing and tried to think nothing. How much longer can a financial system that depends on the Federal Reserve to purchase $85 billion in U.S. Treasury bonds, much of it worthless subprime mortgages, each month survive? How much more money, we are now at $15 to $20 trillion, can be looted from the U.S. Treasury by big banks and Wall Street firms before the financial system again implodes? How much longer can wages be driven down and suppressed while interest rates, which can soar to 30%, cripple us with debt peonage? The ecosystem is at the same time swiftly disintegrating. Scientists from the International Program on the State of the Ocean a few days ago issued a new report that warned that the oceans are changing faster than anticipated and increasingly becoming inhospitable to life. The excess CO2 and heat from the atmosphere is rapidly warming and acidifying ocean seas. This is compounded, the report noted, by increased levels of deoxygenation from nutrient runoffs from farming and climate change. The scientists call these effects a deadly trio that, when combined, are creating changes in the seas that, in their words, are unprecedented in the planet's history. The scientists wrote that each of the Earth's five known mass extinctions was preceded by at least one of these deadly trios: acidification, warming, and deoxygenation. They warned that, quote, the next mass extinction of sea life is already underway, the first such mass extinction in 55 million years. The University of Hawaii also released a new report saying that the effects of climate change are now inevitable. They cannot be stopped. At best, the rate of devastation can be slowed. The report predicted that over the next 50 years, temperature levels will rise to such a degree that human life in many parts of the planet will become unsustainable. Millions upon millions of people will flee as refugees. Millions of species will face extinction. Coastal cities such as New York and even inland cities such as London will become unlivable. Microbes seem set to inherit the earth. Yet we, like Ahab and his crew, do not change course. We do not trust our eyes or our brains. We trust in the myth of human progress, the absurd belief that human technology and ingenuity will save us, that somehow, although no one spells out how, we will all be able to adapt. This myth is abetted by the corporate assault on culture, journalism, education, the arts, and critical thinking. Those who speak the truth are marginalized and ignored, dismissed as pessimists in a culture that prides itself on a childlike optimism at the expense of reality. We have a mania for hope, which our corporate masters lavishly provide across the political and cultural spectrum to keep us passive. Friedrich Nietzsche in Beyond Good and Evil wrote that only a few people have the fortitude to look into what he calls the molten pit of human reality. A handful of artists and philosophers, for Nietzsche, are consumed by an insatiable curiosity, a quest for truth, a desire for meaning, and this sends them down into the bowels of the pit. They get as close as they can before the flames and heat drive them back. This understanding, Nietzsche wrote, comes at a high cost. Those singed by the fire become burnt children, eternal orphans in empires of illusion. Dying civilizations make war on independent intellectual inquiry, art and culture, on the burnt children. The masters of the corporate state do not want us to peer into the pit or heed the cries of those who have seen what awaits us. The corporate state rather feeds the thirst for illusion, happiness, and hope. It peddles the fantasy of endless material progress. It insists, and this is the argument of globalization, that our voyage is unalterable, decreed by natural law. It is part of the march of human progress, and those who challenge this myth are heretics. Clive Hamilton, in his book Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change, describes a kind of dark relief that comes from accepting that catastrophic climate change is virtually certain. This obliteration of false hopes, he says, requires an intellectual knowledge and an emotional knowledge. The first is attainable. The second, because it means those we love, including our children, will face insecurity, misery, and suffering within a few decades, if not a few years, is much harder to acquire. To emotionally accept impending disaster, to attain the gut-level understanding that the power elite will not respond rationally to collapse, is as difficult to accept as our own mortality. The most daunting existential struggle of our time is to ingest this awful truth intellectually and emotionally, and yet rise up to resist the corporate forces that are destroying us. The human species, led by white Europeans and Euro-Americans, has been on a 500-year-long planet-wide rampage of conquering, plundering, looting, exploiting, and polluting the Earth, as well as killing the indigenous communities that stood in the way. But the game is up. The technological and scientific forces that created a life of unparalleled luxury as well as unrivaled military and economic power for a small global elite are the forces that now doom us. The capitalist quest for ceaseless economic expansion has become a curse, a death sentence. But even as our economic and environmental systems unravel, after the hottest year in the contiguous 48 states since record-keeping began 107 years ago, we lack the vision and the courage to shut down the engines of global capitalism. Complex civilizations, as many anthropologists have observed, have a habit of ultimately destroying themselves. The difference is that when we go down this time, the whole planet will go with us. There will, with this final collapse, be no new lands to exploit, no new civilizations to conquer, no new peoples to subjugate, no new resources to plunder. Collapse occurs in complex societies not long after they reach their period of greatest power and prosperity. One of the most pathetic aspects of human history is that every civilization expresses itself most pretentiously, compounds its partial and universal values most convincingly, and claims immortality for its finite existence at the very moment when the decay which leads to death has already begun, Reinhold Niebuhr wrote. The ancient Mayan, the Sumerians of what is now southern Iraq, ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, even Easter Island, were destroyed by the mechanisms that once made them prosper. The novel ways these civilizations found to exploit the environment, such as the invention of irrigation systems, eventually created disastrous, unforeseen complications. Ronald Wright, in A Short History of Progress, calls this the progress trap. The Industrial Revolution created technological civilizations of such complexity and such dependence on ceaseless exploitation, Wright notes, that we do not know how to make do with less or reduce our demands on nature. We know only how to service and maintain a system that is now killing us. This is the evolutionary history of the human race. Our bankers, corporate boards, politicians, television personalities, and generals hold up seductive images of unrivaled wealth and power. Like Ahab and his crew, these images spur us towards self-annihilation. All my means are sane, Ahab says, my motive and my object mad. Melville, who had been a sailor on clipper ships and whalers, was aware that the wealth of industrialized societies was violently seized from the wretched of the earth. All the authority figures on the ship are white men, Ahab, Starbuck, Flask, and Stubb. The hard, dirty work, from harpooning to gutting the carcasses of whales, is the task of the poor, mostly men of color. Melville saw how European plundering of indigenous cultures from the 16th to the 19th century, coupled with the use of African slaves as a workforce to replace the natives, enriched Europe and the United States. The Spanish conquest of the Americas set in motion 5 centuries of reckless economic and environmental plunder. Karl Marx and Adam Smith each attributed the huge influx of wealth from the Americas as having been made possible by the Industrial Revolution and modern capitalism. The Industrial Revolution equipped technologically advanced states with refined weapon systems, turning us into the most efficient killers on the planet. Ahab, when he first appears on the quarterdeck, after being in his captain for the first few days of the voyage, holds up a doubloon, an extravagant gold coin, and promises it to the crew member who first spots the white whale. He knows that the permanent constitutional condition of the manufactured man is sordidness, and he plays to this sordidness. The whale becomes, like everything in the capitalist world, a commodity, a source of personal profit. A murderous greed, one that Starbuck denounces as blasphemous, immediately grips the crew. Ahab's obsession infects the ship. The ship, described by Melville as a hearse, was painted black. The fires used to melt the whale blubber at night turned the Pequod into a red hell. And we live now on our own hearse, our own raging fires, leaping up from our oil refineries and the explosions of our ordnance across the Middle East, bespeak our lust for blood and profit. And in our mad pursuit, we ignore the suffering of those who impede our hunt, just as Ahab does when he refuses to help the captain of a passing ship who is frantically searching for his son who has fallen overboard. Ahab is not solely reliant on the heated rhetoric of persuasion. He oversees a terrifying internal security force on the ship, the 5 dusky phantoms that seem fresh formed out of air. Ahab's secret private whaleboat crew, his private mercenaries, keeps the rest of the ship in abject submission. The art of propaganda and the use of brutal coercion and fear are the familiar tools of tyranny. And our lives are as circumscribed as the lives of the crew on Melville's ship. The novel, in essence, is the chronicle of the last days of a civilization. Melville knew that physical courage and moral courage are distinct. Mutiny was the only salvation for the Pequod's crew. It is our only salvation, but moral cowardice turns us into hostages. The revolutionists of history counted on a mobilized base of enlightened industrial workers. The building blocks of revolt, they believed, relied on the tool of the general strike, the ability of workers to cripple the mechanisms of production. Strikes could be sustained with the support of political parties, strike funds, and union halls. But now, with the decimation of the U.S. manufacturing base, along with the dismantling of our unions and opposition parties, we will have to search for different instruments of rebellion. Most manufacturing jobs have disappeared, and of those that remain, few are unionized. Our family farms have been destroyed by agribusinesses. Monsanto and its Faustian counterparts on Wall Street rule. They are steadily poisoning our lives and rendering us powerless. The corporate leviathan, which is global, is freed from the constraints of a single nation state or government. Corporations are beyond regulation or control. Politicians are too anemic, or more often too corrupt, to stand in the way of the accelerating corporate destruction. This makes our struggle different from the revolutionary struggles in industrial societies in the past. The dispossessed working poor, along with unemployed college students and graduates, unemployed journalists, lawyers and teachers, along with impoverished artists, will form our movement. And this is why the fight for a higher minimum wage is crucial to uniting service workers with the alienated college-educated sons and daughters of the declining middle class. It is not the poor who make revolutions. It is those who conclude that they will not be able, as they once expected, to rise economically and socially. Service workers and fast food workers know they are trapped, as does the swelling population of college graduates caught in a vice of low-paying jobs and obscene amounts of debt. These two groups, once united, will be our primary engines of revolt. Much of the urban poor has been crippled, and in many cases broken, by a rewriting of laws, especially drug laws, that has permitted courts, probation officers, parole boards, and police to randomly seize poor people of color, especially African-American men, without just cause, and lock them in cages for years. In many of our most impoverished urban centers, our internal colonies, as Malcolm X called them, mobilization will be difficult. The urban poor are in chains, and those chains are being readied for the rest of us. Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan examined 100 years of violent and nonviolent resistant movements in their book, Why Civil Resistance Works. They concluded that nonviolent movements succeed twice as often as violent uprisings. Violent movements work primarily in civil wars or in ending foreign occupations, they found. Nonviolent movements appeal to those within the power structure, especially the police and civil servants, who are cognizant of the corruption and decadence of the power elite and are willing in the end to abandon them. And we need only 1 to 5% of the population actively working for the overthrow of a system, history has shown, to bring down even the most ruthless totalitarian structures. Rebellion works on two tracks, building alternative structures, such as public banks, to free ourselves from the control, and finding mechanisms to halt the machine. The most important impediment facing us now is not ideological. It is logistical. The security and surveillance state has made its highest priority the breaking of any infrastructure that might spark widespread unrest or revolt. The state knows the tinder is there. It knows that the continued unraveling of the economy and the effects of climate change make popular unrest inevitable. It knows that as underemployment and unemployment doom at least a quarter of the U.S. population, perhaps more, to perpetual poverty. And as unemployment benefits are scaled back, as schools close, as the middle class withers away, as pension funds are looted by hedge fund thieves, and as the government continues to let the fossil fuel industry ravage the planet, the future will increasingly be one of open conflict. The battle against the corporate state right now is primarily about building an infrastructure to sustain resistance. The state, in its internal projections, has a vision of the future that is as dystopian as mine. But the state, to protect itself, uses its mechanisms of propaganda to assure us that we can continue to build a society based on limitless growth, profligate consumption, and a dependence on fossil fuel. The mania for hope is fed at the expense of truth. The corporate state, meanwhile, is preparing secretly for the world it knows is actually coming. It is cementing into place a pervasive police state, one that includes the complete evisceration of our most basic civil liberties and the militarization of the internal security apparatus, as well as the wholesale surveillance of the citizenry. Those with the moral courage to expose this security and surveillance apparatus, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Jeremy Hammond, are criminalized and persecuted. We can surmount despair, not by ignoring reality, but by responding radically to it. And this includes acts of civil disobedience, including jail time. In these acts, we become fully human. I do not know if we can build a better society. I do not even know if we will survive as a species. But I know these corporate forces have us by the throat, and they have my children by the throat. I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. It is time for our own mutiny, for the overthrow of our own Ahabs, for the redirecting of our ship away from certain death back towards life. No matter how bleak things get, we always have a choice in life. We can choose to be rebels or slaves, and that choice is one the corporate state is powerless to take from us. And to rebel, even if we fail, is to succeed. We must become a threat to the security and surveillance state and its corporate overlords, and we cannot become a threat if we do not engage in actions that actively obstruct power. The Turkish poet Nazım Hikmet, who spent most of his adult life in prison or in exile, knew something of despair. But he knew something, too, of resistance, of that rebellious spirit which must define us in times of oppression if we are to remain fully human. Any act of resistance, large or small, he wrote from inside his prison cell, is its own eternal triumph. Any act of resistance lights up the night sky to remind us why we were created.
As the ship Pequod lit up the night sky processing whale oil, as America's Hellfire missiles light up the sky burning the children of Yemen and Pakistan and Afghanistan, as the artist gazes into the fiery pit of reality and emerges singed like a burnt child, says Nietzsche, so let the citizens, rebelling nonviolently but rebelling, light up the night sky with our acts of resistance. So urges Chris Hedges in his powerful speech at Moravian College, October 22, 2013. You'll find a link to the complete speech on video at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust for New World Notes. Thank you for listening. You'll get to my non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by Jeffrey Gerard, who wrote the book Truthers. It's listed as a young adult thriller, but I read it and couldn't put it down. Jeffrey Gerard is the author of several other books, including Project Cain, a 2013 Bram Stoker Award nominee for Superior Achievement in a Young Adult Novel. He has degrees in English literature and creative writing. He currently lives in Ohio, where he chairs the English department at a private boys' high school. And this is what a few people have said about his book. Quote, with compelling characters and nonstop action, Truthers will leave you thinking. And another comment about the book is, quote, Gerard is a skilled storyteller, weaving history and conspiracy into a thriller that's bold, smart, and impossible to put down. And the last quote I'll share with you about the book says, it examines one of the most critically regarded events in history through the eyes of a tenacious teen who kept me up at night challenging the things I previously regarded as fact. A deep yet approachable story, both thrilling and touching. Jeffrey Gerard's book, Truthers, came out in 2017, and here he is to discuss it with us. Jeffrey Gerard, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on. Appreciate it.
Maybe you can tell us what motivated you to write the book, Truthers.
Well, I am a high school English teacher, and very often, especially with my young adult fiction, so I teach high school, but I write on the side. And my students will sometimes bring stuff up that gets me noodling. And let's see, my freshmen weren't alive when 9/11 happened, and my seniors were, like 2 or 3 years old, maybe. And so the only thing they really know about 9/11, or quite honestly, in quotes, the only thing they really care about it, because it's ancient history to them. I mean, they weren't either alive or, it's, you know, they were 3 years old. So the only thing that really interests them or that they know about is the conspiracy stuff. And that's sort of their starting point, or at least that's how I saw it, as a starting point. As a teacher, my job is to figure out, okay, what are high school kids interested in, and if I can use that to get them to Edgar Allan Poe or Shakespeare or, you know, what mm-hmm. happened on 9/11, something that happened before they were born, then I'll take that opportunity. So they're interested in the conspiracy stuff, and I started from there. I imagine this tale where a high school girl is in the exact same boat that my current students are, where they've heard of 9/11, yeah, they kind of know what happened, but haven't given it any real serious thought. And as the character in the book explores more, she sort of uncovers more stuff that makes her uncomfortable and does the digging that, you know, people don't really do anymore. The idea.
And so had you already done research on 9/11, or was it your students' questioning that made you actually do the research yourself?
Done a little bit. I mean, I'm of an age that, you know, I was alive when it happened, so for me, I'd done some reading on my own and was certainly, like, I'm trying to, like, where do I want to admit to being on the spectrum on these things? I never felt that the public has gotten full disclosure by any means on what happened. And so just as a citizen, yes, I had read a little bit and had read some books, and so the interest was there, and I'd done a little bit of reading. And I think when these guys sort of started asking questions one day, and I realized that I was teaching kids who weren't alive when it happened, and the only thing they know about it is, you know, some very easy joke like, "Oh, Bush did it," and I'm like, "Well, do you even know what that means? Like, when you say that, what exactly are you saying?" And mm-hmm. You know, and to just sort of take it from there. Then I did a ton of reading. Research is my favorite part of writing, and that has been the case for whatever it is I'm writing about. And so I did easily 6 months of research before I wrote down a single word of this book. I went off and read just about everything I could get my hands on, all sides of what happened that day, official versions, unofficial versions, questions of, et cetera, et cetera.
And why a novel? Why did you choose to write a novel as opposed to a nonfiction book about 9/11?
That's a good question. Again, I guess I think that's sort of me trying to bridge to a group that might not otherwise have read the book kind of thing. I thought by couching it in nonfiction that the reader could experience this through the eyes with this main character. The character in the book, Katie, like I said, she's a teen girl, and her father says you're a survivor of the 9/11 conspiracy, and that when passengers were taken off the plane that day and drones were sent instead, that you were sort of snuck off the plane, and we've been raising you ever since, sort of secretly. And so she has to explore all sides, both sides, do her research, do some homework, go into some places that are, you know, darker or more off-field than she expected, but also to sort of take some of that a little more seriously than she might have, and also to look into the history of that day and the history of what came after 9/11, what led up to, perhaps, historically, politically kind of thing. And it just seemed like fiction was a good place. Well, it's funny. We were just talking about it. We just started a new semester today in class. I teach a horror class also. And I was talking about how fiction, what all English teachers say, fiction is a great allegory. It's a bridge and avenue to discuss real things, but sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say protects is not the right word, but it allows you to talk about things that you might not otherwise be able to talk about in a comfortable way. And so I think by setting this in a fictional world and having these characters sort of wrestle with these questions, it felt like it was a safe space that a teenager might be introduced to 9/11.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Katie, and the basis of the book is basically around her and the Cleveland airport and what happened there on 9/11. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about what happened at the Cleveland airport on 9/11.
Well, I don't know. I can certainly say that. I don't know what happened. I know certainly there was a lot of attention specifically at the Cleveland airport on 9/11. I mean, I know the mayor up there either misspoke or not, and mentioned a plane number that he shouldn't even have known yet. And I know that there are certainly witnesses who claim to have seen all sorts of planes coming in that day and, you know, sort of people being let off for questions. And, you know, I imagine every airport in the country was all heck was breaking loose that day. So, but the Cleveland airport just kept coming up as sort of like a spot where here is a theory, here is the main theory with the Cleveland airport, is this idea that that was the spot where they brought in the different flights. If, for instance, you believe or are curious or think that perhaps the planes were replaced with drones or, you know, military planes or something like that, and that we have a pretty good idea that, again, there's so many if. If you believe the passengers went up that day and did not go into the buildings, but in fact there is the possibility, there is the belief, that they were instead brought to sort of the Cleveland airport and all sort of led off together somewhere, and there's five different places on where that might be, that somewhere might be, but that it seems that like Cleveland seems to be the hot spot for this, where it might have happened. It makes sense for where planes sort of vanished off radar for a little bit, and It's close to where things sort of turned around, and it's close. It's sort of like a good location for where these planes might have landed and some funny business might have happened. So it seems like a lot of attention focuses there. And what this novel presupposes is that perhaps something did happen there, and that this is where this girl was sort of snuck off one of the planes, like Moses and the bulrushes kind of thing, and has been raised ever since.
So I thought that was an interesting way to start the book and connect it to your local area with your students being in Ohio, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and what kind of reaction have you gotten from your students about the book?
That's funny. The strongest reaction you get, and I don't know about you, what you encounter out in the world, because the folks who are just like, oh, yeah, this is kind of cool, or this is interesting, or I didn't know that, you get that group. The biggest reaction you get are the people who, like, can't stand the idea of the book, like the idea that that's even possible. And I, of course, encourage that. I mean, as a teacher, that's fantastic. So it's funny, the strongest reactions I've gotten are the guys who come in and like, dude, this is ridiculous. I don't even understand why you're writing it. But there are also guys that have brought the book, right? So they're like reading it, and they come back and they're telling me like, oh, you know, I'm in chapter here and this and that. And they're not complaining about the book or how bad the book is or something. They're just they're not buying the premise necessarily, but mm-hmm. they keep pushing through it, and then we come in and have those conversations. And for me, that's a win. That's as a teacher, as a writer, that's all I ever want. I want those conversations. So the strongest reaction is the, no, there's no way that would ever happen kind of stuff, but mm-hmm. those turn into good conversations. And other than that, just general support, cool book and interesting book and all that kind of stuff. Actually, this year, one of the other teachers in the school is going to use it. He's doing something on sort of media literacy, and they're studying conspiracy theories because they're so, I mean, they've been around for 1,000 years, but getting more and more popular for a host of reasons. So he's actually going to do a unit on conspiracy theory, and he plans to use this book. I won't yet. That's too brazen on my part, but another one of the teachers in the school plans to.
And the students, you say, have a real interest in the conspiracy stuff, so that is one way to get them reading and discussing and thinking.
Right, absolutely.
I was doing some tabling in Maine at a fair the past few years, and the students, it's the young kids, the students who come to me and they say, you know, we're studying 9/11 in our classes, and they wanted our stuff. They are leaning more towards the conspiracy side as opposed to what the government's telling us, which I find encouraging because it does show some critical thinking on their part. So I've had that similar experience with students that age.
I mean, the same thing happened with Kennedy. It's just sort of like each generation, the percentages of people that believe that something funny happened there, just it increases as every generation. I mean, every decade you can add 10% to the people who believe that there was a major conspiracy involved.
Right. And I think if you didn't live through the propaganda that the media and the government put out right when the events happen, you haven't been brainwashed or conditioned to believe what they're telling you. So I think younger kids tend to be more open because they didn't live through that. That's my take on it anyway.
No, it makes sense.
So what you did a lot of research for the book, obviously. What resources did you find most helpful? Are there any that you would recommend?
At the back of the book, I have sort of the bibliography. I don't want to rip on the commission report, but I started there. David Ray Griffin, I'm sure, is a name that mm-hmm. you and anyone listening to this knows very well. So I found his books very, very helpful. I went back to them a lot. Again, I try to do both sides, all sides, various things. He was sort of like the cornerstone. Like I said, there's a bibliography in the book. I don't even want to pick certain people out.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, actually. And you have David Ray Griffin here, of course. You have Kevin Ryan, Another 19, Michael Rupert. Those are all great.
Rupert's was good, yeah. Thank you for calling that one out.
Crossing the Rubicon. Yeah. And then you also have Jonathan Kay here. I know you were trying to be neutral and present both sides, but but his book, Among the Truthers, I found to be the biggest piece of propaganda.
You know what? I'm going to try to stay relatively unbiased through this on that one. I agree with you. I found, you know, I had to put it in there. I mean, I didn't have to put it in there. I thought it was fair to put it in there because I read it, and my copy of that book is written in the margins and across paragraphs, and it's basically me just yelling at this guy. yes, I thought there were sections that were very well done, and I thought there were sections that were completely sort of like snotty and obnoxious, and like he'd say something, and I'm just sitting there, and I think I'm pretty in the middle on this, open to many ideas, and he would say something, and I'd be like, dude, that is just really disrespectful. But, you know, yeah, I mean, that's out there.
Yeah, he had a lot of sort of ad hominem attacks in there on people in the truth movement.
I thought so, too. Like, yeah. Completely, like, dude, like, unnecessary. Sorry, just dude-ed him. But yeah. Unnecessary.
But that was, like, the point of the book is to make people who were investigating it look stupid or something. So,
and actually, you know what? I'm going to say it for your listeners. Anyone who wants to read the book, I certainly encourage you to read my book, Truthers. Read the book, and I'm going to tell you straight up. You know, I'm not going to get into it. Never mind. You can edit that. Let's put it this way: there's a recording of the book that's done wonderfully. It's the reader is fantastic, and she does Katie's voice so well. Does a fantastic job. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. Seriously. But I feel even there, I felt there are times when specifically the quote-unquote truther characters are being presented. I don't think they're being presented in the best light by the folks who put that, the audio version.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's just like, it's not really the voice I imagined. And the voices always seem to be a little silly to me, the folks that are most presenting information that's sort of out the mainstream. I'm reading too much into it, but it seemed just like the K book. It was the same kind of thing. It was just sort of a little bit little bit dismissive.
Right.
Usually people who, as I say in the book, Intruders, they go to a convention, and the young genius that she's hanging out with on this little journey points out that, like, hey, this is a room of smart people. Like, these are professionals, right? These are programmers and lawyers and businessmen and women and people with degrees. It's usually the more professional group that's in this room asking these questions. So maybe I do get a little, like, not a group you want to make fun of.
Right. I agree with you on that. And I think sometimes these companies are so nervous that they have to put that sort of spin on it to get it out, to get it published.
I agree. The book's not in there. The publisher is fantastic. And again, if you like audiobooks, give it a shot. I think she did an amazing job with the main character, but I do feel like a couple of the more traditional, quote-unquote, truther characters, I just felt like, what is that voice they're doing? That seems unnecessary. Now, because the main truther in the book, there's a character who sort of does sort of what you do. He runs a radio show, and he has podcasts, and he puts stuff up online and stuff. And I don't know. I just felt like he could have gotten a little more respect in that. He does in the book.
And I really want to encourage people to read your book, even if you don't care about the topic of 9/11. It was a really, like, a great book to read. It was, I couldn't put it down. So it was great.
You.
Yeah, really well written and everything. So, yeah, I applaud you on that. And just while we're commenting about the bibliography, you also have in here Anthony Summers and Robin Swan and The 11th Day, The Full Story of 9/11. And I found that book to be pure propaganda also. They put in just enough to kind of say they've covered it, but they don't give you the real details. And one example is they talk about April Gallup, who was in the Pentagon on 9/11. And they quote her, but they don't quote the real things that she said, like that there was no plane that hit the Pentagon, there was no body parts, no luggage, no plane parts. So it's not the full story of 9/11, even though that's their title. Anyways, and you also mentioned Michelle Chesedovsky, who I think is wonderful from Global Research, the websites. So I like that. Is there anything you'd like to say about the book that I haven't asked you?
Just that I suppose that the book's main goal is to encourage people of all ages, You know, starting with teens, but it's also for adults, too, because we had conversations with the adults today. We're arguing about various political things, and we were arguing about truth or whatever and how to get to truth. And, you know, so truthers, why 9/11 is the sort of cornerstone of what it is, what the book's really getting at is how we as citizens, whether you're 15 or 65, how we break through this, like, selective exposure that we've created for ourselves. It's like we watch the news channels that fit with what we believe, and technology is so amazing. I mean, the fact that you and I are doing this, right? We're talking
right
on the phone, and you're going to put it up, and someone in China could listen to this. I mean, it's amazing. It's powerful. It's necessary. It opens a free world. But it also is so, so messy, because you end up, and I've caught myself doing it on Twitter. You know, let's face it, this is a tough political year for wherever you are. And I found myself sort of blocking people, you know, that move. And people do it all the time, right? Facebook and Twitter and this and that and the other thing, your news feeds. You pick and choose. I want to hear from these people. I don't want to hear from these people. And I'm interested, and 9/11 is sort of like I said, it's a cornerstone of this interest, but how in the future, how in the present, how are we going to make decisions and know truth when we sort of, we're putting ourselves in specific little ponds, you know, selective exposure. Like, I only want to hear from these people, from these sources, and it becomes this huge echo chamber so fast that the book's point was two things. One, to encourage teens and 90-year-olds to get out of that pond a little bit and check out other ponds. That way you're not being snotty, right, when you're talking about someone who believes something differently than you do. Should be an intellectual discussion. It should be a discussion in which you bring up facts and you argue a little bit and you say, hey, why this and you have that, and you go through that. I think that should be part of the process of being a citizen. Sounds super corny, but that's, otherwise we're just going to be in these little, small little teapots saying things to each other, surrounded by, you know, we'll be preaching to the choir every day. That's all anyone will be doing, and that's not going to be effective. The other thing was what to do with, I've almost, as the book went on, I almost gave up on, not in a negative way, I almost gave up on, like, finding truth. I don't even know if it's possible, which has probably become too philosophic, and it's, I don't know if we're ever going to know what happened on 9/11, or what happened at this election, or what happened with Kennedy, or what happened to the Lucidity. I don't know if we're ever going to know these things. Even the people that were involved, how many fully know what happened? And so I'm trying to do something I think, thematically with the book, and maybe a takeaway, and hopefully this, I found strength in this. Instead of being sort of nervous or bothered by that, I'm not saying I'm going to give up searching. I think the search for the truth is probably like my favorite thing on earth to do. At the end of the day, it's sort of like, what do you do with your version of the truth, right? Like, you're going to gather all this information, and you know what? I've really thought about this, and here's what I think happened. I'm more interested in that next step. So therefore, what do? You, for instance, you started this show, right? And you reach out to people, mm-hmm. and you're involved, and you sat at that table, and you talked to the high school. Like, what will you do? So whatever you believe happened this year in the election or this or that or the other thing, like, what did you do the next morning? Did you get up? Did you run for office? Did you start volunteering here or there? Did you go down here and do some more local service? Did you write a book about this? Did you start researching, like, what action did you take based on your truth?
Don't be a passive citizen. Yes, I hear you. Don't be passive and get involved.
Yeah, because we're going to argue with each other for 10,000 years on what the truth is on any given event. I think we should. Afterward, what are you doing with your version of truth? How are you going to make the world better? Now that you think that that's the version of the truth, what will you do to make this a better place?
Right. Knowledge alone isn't enough. You do have to take some action, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I do have to say, I understand what you're saying when you say we don't know, we may never know what happened, but I have to disagree a little bit, because in the Kennedy assassination, there is so much research that I think we do have a pretty good idea of what happened, and certainly we have a good idea what didn't happen. And we also, on 9/11, I mean, there's mountains of evidence. We kind of do know the general outline of what happened and what didn't happen, and we don't have all the details, but... And with the assassination of Martin Luther King, I mean, we know that. We know, the author William Pepper has done a great book on that. He's done 30 years of research. We kind of know. There's a knowing, and then there's a public acknowledgement of what we know. And I think that's what we're not getting, is the public, government, media, corporate media acknowledgement of what we do know. I understand what you're saying, but I think there is a fake news. The real fake news is the alphabet soup corporate media, really. Your thoughts?
Understood.
Okay. You're not going to...
No, I understand what you were saying, and I do not disagree with it.
Okay. Well, is there any part of the book... Would you like to read an excerpt from the book?
Okay, fair enough. I should be able to do the first chapter, right? So I'll just start there, because if that doesn't grab your interest, then I have failed. But if you're more, they know where to go. All right.
Okay.
Chapter 1, Truthers. They killed her. Killed all of them. This is what her father said. Half a dozen times that she could remember, when he was very tired and high, they killed her, killed all of them. I'm sorry. He'd said it again two nights before they took him away. The police car that pulled up to her house at night didn't surprise or alarm Katie. It wasn't the first time. Neighbors could be so noisy. She'd even seen her father arrested once, misdemeanor marijuana. But this night, there were two police cars, an especially marked sheriff's office car. And now a black car in a weird yellow van pulling up her driveway. Her immediate guess was that her father was dead, reeking of pot and or beer, and wrapped around some telephone pole, or worse and more likely, smashed into an SUV filled with some family who'd been racing on the tangled pathways of destiny toward this unhappy man for years. It finally happened, she thought. And now all these cars, all these people huddled in small circles up and down her driveway, people talking, pointing, organizing to fully include her in today's tragedy. Katie stepped back from the window, the world quiet and still, as she deliberated how to behave when they officially told her. Cry, scream, act surprised. She felt too disconnected from herself for real thought, her brain unexpectedly empty, this space for rent, entirely without the solutions that always came. Finally, a knock at the door, thank God, she thought. Because a knock was a sound, and sound was something real and hinted at next steps, at least a next step. And she opened her front door slowly, and a tall shadow filled the space behind. Caitlin Wallace? The tall shadow asked. She managed only a nod. It was as if death himself had come to her door, dropping by to explain all the complexities of the universe. She almost found the idea funny and might even have laughed if she weren't also so terrified. Death leaned forward and, of course, became a man. Round face, gray goatee, no side or glistening black eye sockets, but a leather folder and a black baseball cap that said Sheriff. Sheriff Matheson, he confirmed, and asked her if he could come in. More shadows hovered directly behind him, and there was some discussion regarding whether she was a Caitlin or a Kate or etc., and she may have answered, but wasn't really listening yet, merely staring. Outside, the nasty rainstorm that had swept through had passed, its gloom and dankness trailing after, and some cops stood posted in their driveway. A half dozen neighbors confirmed their noisiness, their faces flush and hellish in the lone red light, revolving slowly atop one of the police cars. The sheriff had entered her house, and then half a dozen other equally tall, dark shapes, several men in suits, another cop, and a woman in plain clothes, followed him and crowded her hallway as Katie was led to a living room, already a guest in her own home. "This is Gloria Dorsey," the sheriff said, introducing the woman. She was middle-aged, dressed like a modest school teacher, short, jagged blonde hair. She looked eager to take over. "Miss Dorsey, is he dead?" Katie asked. She also wanted to take over, but still felt weirdly apart from her own words and movements. The sheriff sighed, almost chuckled. "Oh, no, little lady, no, no, no. Your dad is fine," the Dorsey woman said. She'd taken a spot beside Katie on the couch, though Katie had no recollection of even sitting. Struggling for the reaction to the idea her father was still alive proved as elusive as what she might do if he were dead. "He's perfectly fine," the woman said. "We should have told you that right away." The woman shot a look at the sheriff, and his whole face tightened some. Katie asked, "Is he in jail?" "He's at the hospital," the sheriff replied. "Ventworth." Katie'd never heard of it. Behind the sheriff, the others scurried around her house, around it, through it, over it. Doing what, she had no clue. The cop had stayed back in the front hallway, and one man, well, this guy she'd not noticed before. He now stood off to the side in the entrance to the kitchen, watching her. And while all the others moved in a sort of intense frenzy, this guy looked perfectly calm, chewing gum even, almost amused, smiling. "I don't understand," Katie said, looking away, reality returning fast now, pursuing something they'd said. "You said he was fine, so why is he at the hospital?" The sheriff and the Dorsey woman shared a look. "There was an incident at work," Dorsey explained. "Work? Her dad was a maintenance groundskeeper type for park services, cutting out honeysuckle, putting in new picnic tables, etc. What kind of incident would he?" "The doctors believe your father had a panic attack of some kind," said Dorsey. "A nervous breakdown," the sheriff amended. "So, nothing to do with honeysuckle." "Of course not." Katie thought about some of the things her dad had said to her recently, stranger than usual even. And because it was tricky to separate them all, she even thought about some of the things he'd said for many years. A breakdown. His whole damn life had been a breakdown. "They don't know for sure what it was," Dorsey said, interrupting Katie's racing thoughts. "But he's gone to spend at least tonight at the hospital." Pause. "Maybe longer. And he was worried about you here being alone." Katie made a face, calling Dorsey's lie. She spent most of her life alone in the house, this one and all the others before it, while her father was off fishing or holed up in some nasty bar after work or God knows what. He wouldn't give one shit if she spent another night alone. "We were worried," Dorsey corrected, and then presented her most professional, "I know what you're going through" face before her next words. "You're a minor, Katie." Finally, Katie realized what was going on. Her dad was already at some hospital. They hadn't come for him. They'd come for her. There was no known next of kin. No grandparents or aunts or second cousins. No one. Only her dad, a.k.a. the man in prison in some psychiatric hospital called Vent Something. And so the Dorsey woman helped Katie collect her school bag and fill a county supply gym bag, said Butler County Social Services right on the side, with some clothes, and then led her to the weird yellowy van, and the sheriff followed. Katie had gone on autopilot again. She had little memory of stepping outside or moving down the rain-stained driveway with Dorsey or getting into the van. She sat alone in the middle row of seats while Dorsey shut the side door and then got in the drive. The night still swirling red, neighbors still watching, Mrs. Lindhurst and Gary the Grouch, their stares. And as the van pulled away with her in it, Katie noticed all the lights in her house were still on, the front door wide open, strange men still within. "I want to see my father," Katie said. "Soon," Dorsey replied from up front, but she was lying.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Again, I want to encourage people to read your book, and I think one of the benefits of doing a fiction, a novel about this, is that libraries will carry it where they won't carry some of the other 9/11 truth books that are nonfiction, so that it reaches more people. So I really want to thank you, Jeff, for writing the book and for coming on the show today.
Like I said, thank you so much for inviting me on today and talking to me. I appreciate it.
Okay, and what's next for you? Another book in the works?
Many, many books, yes. Let's see, what's next? I'm writing a book about a Japanese samurai, a book set in 1600s Japan. I spent a month in Japan this summer, and all my research is based on old Japan, feudal Japan right now.
Well, good luck with that, and thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with author Jeffrey Gerard, who wrote the book that came out in 2017 called Truthers. It's a young adult thriller, but most adults I know really enjoyed reading it, and I would highly recommend it. And I want to thank Carl Seeger Henry, who introduced me to this book over lunch a few months ago. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
With Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, teachers and utility workers in Puerto Rico are going to join us to talk about the labor movement after Hurricane Maria and Governor Rossello's plans to privatize the public power company and the schools. We are extremely pleased to have with us Fredison Martinez Estevez, Vice President of the Electrical Workers Union, and Mercedes Martinez Padilla, President of the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Can you tell us, Fredison Martinez Estevez, what actually is the state of the power grid and the restoration of power on the island to begin with?
Here in Puerto Rico, we are facing a major challenge in restoring the power grid on our island. It was affected in about 85% in all the stages of the electricity, especially in transmission and distribution, poles, lines, substations, you know, all the components of the electric grid were affected. The restoration process has been a slow-paced one because of the problem with the materials, the problem with the equipment, the lack of workers with a job, and the slowness in attending this process by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the government of Puerto Rico. Both, they make an agreement to use the Corps of Engineers to bring materials and workers to Puerto Rico, and they have been lacking the agility and speed to help us restore the power on the island. And that it can be seen that more than 4 months after Maria passed over us, we have close to 35-40% of the people of Puerto Rico without power. That's pretty hard on the people. The people are desperate because the governor told the people that on December the 15th, that 95% of Puerto Rico will be energized. That didn't happen. And the people, you know, started in desperation to protest, to be, desperate because of the situation, because they were promised something that wasn't real. And we think that the governor has been playing with this major issue, making promises that can't be made. And because of that, you know, a lot of factors. We have more than 500,000 customers without power, and that goes to more than 1 million people on the island without power more than 4 months after Maria passed over us.
And Mercedes, so talk about what's happening with the education system, with the middle schools, which you are involved in, and then we will continue on what's actually especially happening with the unions, the workers, and where the issue of privatization fits into the, we would suggest, devastation of the workforce, of the labor movement, and for providing services to the island. Mercedes?
Terms of education. The secretary, Julia Kelleher, was appointed by the governor November last year on what she wants to do on public education, which is close down and shut down more than 300 schools, privatize schools, deny the children the right to a quality education as the Constitution guarantees. So she has been straightforward since the first day. She already shut down 166 schools by May. During the hurricane and after the hurricane, she shut down 50 schools additional to the ones that she had already closed. And she had to revoke more than half because of the community organization and the protest from the community. On May, she was trying to shut down approximately 300 schools. The number came down to 166, but it still was too much. So we are at a point where public education is at risk of its mere existence, and the Teachers Federation is organizing the communities to fight back. And an example of that is the example that you just mentioned about the school that we were involved in today, which is Marcelino Canino Junior High, where students, parents, and teachers had a one-day strike today. They were rallying in front of the school because the secretary wants to remove an entire team of teachers from that school. The school was flooded during the hurricane more than 6 feet, and it was precisely the teachers that reconditioned the schools so it will be able to reopen. And this is the way of the department and the secretary of saying thanks to the teachers. They were not there for the teachers or for our schools to recondition them. It was all done by the teachers and the parents. And now, more than 130 days after the hurricane, she decides she's going to start destroying the schools by eliminating teams of teachers. So they were on strike today, and they will continue the strike tomorrow, requesting the secretary to hear the community and revoke the decision of eliminating these teachers from the school.
But it's bouncing off what Mercedes was saying about the governor basically tearing apart the schools. To what extent is the problems with the power system dependent upon the disaster that happened with Maria? And to what extent has it to do with decisions by the power company, probably in consultation with the governor, in terms of how they respond to it? And how does it affect your workers?
The governor of Puerto Rico, you know, well, mostly the governor, has been acting in a kind of way that they were just like waiting for the federal government to make a move, and then they will make theirs. They were feeling like, oh, this is all the fault of FEMA. This is all the fault of U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And in some way, they had some reason in their arguments. But also, the government was very slow in requesting aid, including the PREPA, Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, that we work for. They have a mutual aid agreement with the American Public Power Association. They didn't use that, as has previously happened, and that is normal in the states to do so. But they didn't implement that. They just rely on the Corps of Engineers to do the restoration work. And it has been a very slow-paced one. The government just announced a week ago that he was going to privatize PREPA. In our union, we feel that this is a lack of sensibility by the governor, just taking advantage of the people of Puerto Rico because they're in a desperate need of power. And he just goes like, well, this is the moment to do so because the people are, you know, angry. They're mad, they're sad, they're desperate for power. So he goes like, okay, I'm going to privatize. This is going to solve all the problems. This is going to lower the cost to the rates to the people of Puerto Rico. And, you know, he showed no evidence whatsoever of what he said. He just stated that as a solution. He has no legislation made about that. He makes that in the air. We feel that he's been so insensible to the people of Puerto Rico to announce that in the middle of this crisis, where we have more than 500,000 customers without service, and that by decades the different administrations, including this one, has been giving the workers no materials to work, no equipment, no vehicles. they just are making their way so that the people say, well, HEPA does not serve us well anymore. The electricity costs are too high. We don't need them. They go like making people angry every day against us by not giving the workers the means to put this corporation in the place that it was once. And that happened from some years that they have been working that way. And by Maria passing, it just showed the reality of what is happening over here. It just didn't happen from one day to another. It has been a work by the government and his allies for some years now, trying to show a different face of the workers, of the company, not providing us with the tools, and including we are here in our union. We had some workers from Mexico who were ready to come here, not charging anything, just their stay here in the island, and they said no, you know, and they later signed the contract with Whitefish, all that. Things that happen with rates more than $400 an hour and such. And we have from decades, we have saying that to the people of Puerto Rico, that we have denounced that, and that because the electric power is a human right, not a merchandise, we feel that the government has been has shown no sensibility to the people of Puerto Rico. And to the people who have lost energy, who has lost people because they have died in this process, you know, of diseases, or because not having the power on their houses. And we feel that, you know, no sensibility whatsoever from the government. He said that the company is no longer workable, but that is so suspicious because there are a lot of companies interested in buying or to intervene in the company. And it shows that, you know, the company really has great potential, but, you know, it has to be reformed. It has to be that the politicians did not have the power that they have in the company now. It can be made. In the U.S., there are more than 2,000 public power companies over there, and they serve well the people. So why don't PREPA can do the same? You know, we feel that PREPA can do that, can improve the job, the work that the company does, but we have to be given the means to do so, the tools, the personnel, the vehicles, the workers, foremost the faith in the workers, because we have been here for many years, and we are staying here, you know, to improve our company, to make and to give the people of Puerto Rico the best that we can give to them, because we are staying here. We have a lot of people from the States working here, and we are very grateful for that.
Just to continue this discussion, but to bring Mercedes Martinez Padilla into it as well, the issue of privatization as a political and theoretical issue, we have been cultivated in this country to continuously really harangue public sector unions, public sector workers, and say, ah, the private sector is always more efficient, etc. Mercedes and then Freddie said, what does it politically really mean to privatize the school system? What effect will it have on the jobs of those people, the educators, the utility workers? What will it mean for, indeed, the provision of services and the cost of those provision of services? And is this part of a broader plan on the island? Mercedes?
Well, first, we have to remember that privatization agenda is a corporate capitalist neoliberal agenda that's been tried to be implemented in our country, and it has been implemented in the States as of education for many years now. In Puerto Rico, we still have no charter schools because of the struggle that the communities have led together with the Teachers Federation throughout the years and other unions that are in favor of public education. Privatizing education would mean that the 1% ruling class of the U.S. is going to get richer by the minute and wealthier by the minute, because public funds will go into their pockets and out of our children's school system. The children in a charter school, we have read enough about this and talk to our comrades in the U.S. that have been working in charter schools, that know the system, studies that have been made by Stanford University, that they stay the same. They will deny special education children their right to enroll in a school. A lot of them have admissions through the lottery system, and you can live in front of the school, but if you're not in the lottery, you don't get in. They will try to eliminate low-income students from going to the school because they are blaming those students for the test scores that are used to evaluate the achievement of the schools. The children end up paying for their meals. They can pay for an admission fee. Teachers will be fired. Teachers will have no tenure. Teachers will have no benefits. Teachers will lose all of the rights that they've constructed and had so far, only to make profit for private companies that will use the taxpayers' money to profit themselves, because education for them is a business. We saw what happened in New Orleans after Katrina, and we know that the Secretary of Education in Puerto Rico is trying to implement the New Orleans scheme here in Puerto Rico. She tried to do it during the hurricane. Communities will not allow her to do so, because something different from Katrina is that during Katrina, the government evacuated 1.8 million people, so they were not there to defend their schools because they were evacuated, but we are here. We have not gone anywhere, and we will be here when they come for our schools. We will be here to defend our schools in, because our children need public schools. Public schools are excellent schools. We have excellent teachers. We have excellent students. We know the schools that we want. We know the schools that our children deserve. Public schools can be if they just listen to the proposals that the teachers and the parents have made throughout the years.
Fredison, maybe you can respond to that, because we understand that this is just the beginning, what Governor Rossello announced. There's the issue of privatizing the water and a whole complement of services.
The government has been trying for years to privatize education. They privatized for some time the water company, and that, you know, they had three companies privatizing the Puerto Rico Water Resources Authority, and the government has to take it back because the service was too bad. They didn't lower costs. They included in the cost were raised. The results were nothing close to what they promised. Now that we have also the oversight board over here, and they're strong promoters.
That's what's called the junta?
Yep, the junta.
The emergency control financial board, PROMESA.
Yeah, PROMESA. And they are strong promoters of privatization. And the government has two talks, because they said that, okay, we don't want PROMESA here. We don't want them. We want them out of the island. But the government do like slaves to them, you know. They said they make what the junta wants them to do. They want to privatize. Okay, we're going to privatize. The privatization of PREPA or any other public service, just we have so many evidence here in Puerto Rico to the people that the results are for the workers, lesser rights. They made a work reform to reduce the workers' rights. So, you know, like making the way to privatization, the public companies or the public services that the government offers may seem to the people that want to privatize like more appetizing to them, because, you know, okay, we have a lot of people here, but their rights are not close to what they were, because we being unionized, we fight for our rights, and we have some rights that we have fight for them for a long time. They just make laws to make those rights, like in the 1940s, 1950, you know, we went back in time in the labor movement in Puerto Rico. By that way that the governor is guiding Puerto Rico, we are toward that we are going to have a community and more and the workers with less rights, lower wages here, and that the bridge between the higher class and the lower class will be so high that it will be like, you know, we're going to have here like a vacational spot for some millionaires, and we feel like we did not belong here. We live in our island, but we feel that we don't belong here. And the politics that the government and the governor is making in Puerto Rico are so bad that great deal of people are just leaving the island daily. After Maria, they estimate that more than 100,000 people have left Puerto Rico. The vast majority of that people will not return here because there are no jobs. The government is taking a stand against the workers. It is not attractive anymore to work in the government. And they're making that not just in the electric service, but also in the other public services. And we are sure that they just want to start with the electric company to see what the people react to that. And after that, if they make their way, privatization of PREPA, then it will say, okay, let's privatize all the other, because there are a lot of technocrats.
Mercedes, I know that when this kind of situation happened in New Orleans after Katrina, not only did they privatize the education, but they fired all of the teachers and brought in new teachers from outside of New Orleans. Do you fear that the same kind of situation will happen there, in addition to the impact on the students? The teachers fear for their very jobs and their pensions.
Most definitely. The Secretary of Education just announced with the governor the new fiscal plan that has been sent to be approved by the Oversight Fiscal Board and the House of Representatives and the Senate. And in that fiscal plan, they are telling the country that they are going to lay off 7,000 teachers, mainly teachers that have no tenure, teachers without a contract. So definitely the government is trying to reduce the amount of teachers by a very high number. So the answer will be yes. And besides firing those teachers, they will try to privatize our schools, saying that the schools that remain open don't work. We already know the agenda. And once they go and say that they're going to try to privatize the schools that remain open, and at the same time, privatize the working force within that school. So 7,000 will get laid off, and the other ones will lose their tenure and all of their rights. So obviously, we have a long way to go to fight against all this together as a working class with all of the unions of our country that are willing to fight back, like comrades from the electrical corporation, like Freddie Sun, and all the workers in our country. We are being under attack, and it's going to be solidarity amongst workers, solidarity with our people that will guide us through this.
They keep making complaint about the inefficiencies of PREPA and the millions of dollars in debt. The holders of the utility's $9 billion debt are actually American hedge fund and mutual funds. So I wonder if you can talk about whether or not, as part of the collective struggle against privatization, there is a role that kind of coincides with a general fight against the austerity budget and plans implemented as a result of the islands essentially being under the control of PROMESA.
You know, that's for sure. The way of work of the hedge funds, for example, in the period between 2008 and 2012, the debt of PREPA doubled from $4 billion to $9 billion in just that period. There were a lot of bonds emissions, and most of those were bought by the hedge funds. And we have today the result of the neoliberal positions of the government. We are paying that today with maybe the loss of one of the biggest assets in Puerto Rico, being PREPA. in the public utility sectors, it is the number one corporation in customers and in the top 10 in generation, in revenues, in infrastructure. It is a corporation that it has a lot of value. It was evaluated by the politics of the government, but we have a great asset, and we have to keep it in our hands. We have to reform PREPA, that's for sure. It can't work the way that it's been working. You know, it has to be reformed, but in the hands of the people. The people has a right to have power in their houses, and we feel that we can do that. In the electric company, we can do that in education. And as unionized workers, we started today to do so. We started meetings. We started to receive ideas from other unions in Puerto Rico to defend the public corporation that is PREPA. And by defending PREPA, we are starting to make a coalition of all the workers here in Puerto Rico to defend their jobs, to defend the public service, because it is that. It is a service, and it has to be offered with no means of earning money by it. It is just a service, and the only guarantee that it can keep that way is to be in the hands of the government, but it has to be in a good government that responds to the people and not just to politics of promesa and such as that.
And, of course, Puerto Rico was ripped apart by Hurricane Maria, but it was also ripped apart by the colonialist process that has controlled it for years, by the austerity work and budget of PROMESA. And Mercedes Martinez Padilla, we're going to give you the last word. What do we do to support our sisters and brothers? And again, we have been speaking with Fredison Martinez Estevez, Vice President of the Irrigation and Electrical Workers Union, and Mercedes Martinez Padilla, President of the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico, about privatization of their unions. But it looks like all the work on the island and public sector jobs. So what do we do to support our sisters and brothers? Mercedes?
You could help us in so many ways. First, to denounce what's happening in our country, to make our voice your voice and our demands your demands, which will be we need the abolition of the PROMESA Act, which is a dictatorship in our country where seven people are ruling austerity measures against the Puerto Rican people. Because of these austerity measures, we need that law to be abolished. We need the debt to be eliminated. 100 years of exploitation to the Puerto Rican people has been more than enough to pay that illegal $72 billion debt, which has been implemented on us with all these measures. We need the Jones Act to be abolished. You can help us calling your congressman, tweeting the governor of Puerto Rico, tweeting the president of the House of Representatives and the Senate by being our voice in the states, because it's not a struggle in defense of public education itself or in defense of energy. Is the people of Puerto Rico are fighting for their life against austerity measures. Teachers, mainly women, are being affected in a huge manner, being deprived of the right to live because all of these austerity measures are just so much. And we are getting organized. Today we were in a meeting with electrical workers and with many other unions that are willing to work and join forces. So it's just one working class in Puerto Rico. It's just one working class in the U.S. The 1% has the wealth, but we have the strength if we unite. So we just ask you to be our voice in the States.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Awesome array of black drag queens coming on, and I feel like I'm just
getting out and hanging with my people. So Mardi Gras is like Christmas to me.
It's all about making sure that we get supported and have a space to be able to celebrate 40 years of the Mardi Gras as well as 30 years of existence for Bumali Aboriginal Artist Cooperative as well.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Indonesian lawmakers pursue broad restrictions on sex, Myanmar pride doubles in the daylight, and a queer Cori component adds color to Sydney's Mardi Gras. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 3rd, 2018. Opponents of LGBT rights in Indonesia were rebuffed by the country's Supreme Court in December when it rejected their petition to outlaw all forms of sex outside of heterosexual marriage. Anti-queer members of Indonesia's parliament this week proposed legislation to do the job. The world's largest Muslim-majority nation has traditionally enjoyed secular governance. But draft legislation published this week outlaws extramarital sex, relations between members of the same gender, and cohabitation. It reportedly has support from most of the Southeast Asian nation's 10 political parties, especially the provisions that ban gay sex. Junimart Gersang, a member of the Parliamentary Commission from the Nationalist Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle that's studying the draft bill, told Reuters that, in legal terms, religious terms, and ethical terms, we cannot have that in our country. Virtually every other Indonesian politician is positioning him or herself ahead of national, legislative, and presidential elections next year. It could still take more than a year for MPs to agree on all the specifics of the legislation.
A Jakarta-based national polling firm reported this week that 88% of its 1,200 survey respondents think that LGBT people are a threat to private or public life, and almost 82% believe that their religion condemns same-gender sex. The relative good news is that 58% said that LGBT people have the right to live in the country and that the government should protect them like other citizens. That's little solace to a dozen transgender beauty salon operators and their workers and customers who were caught up in raids this week in Aceh province, which has special permission from the federal government to operate under strict Sharia or Islamic law. Authorities invaded five different salons, roughed up many of the detainees, and shaved the heads of at least two trans women to turn them into men. Officials told the press that it was part of their effort to eradicate a growing social disease. Photos of the raids have come to the attention of the National Police Force, which is reportedly looking into any procedural or ethical violation. Several other beauty salon owners have temporarily shut down, fearing raids by Muslim fundamentalist civilians. One activist believes that about 40 trans people have fled Aceh altogether.
And following up on our report last week, tech giant Google has bowed to a request by the Indonesian government to remove the gay dating app Blude from its Google Play Store. Created in China, Blude is one of the world's most popular gay dating apps with some 27 million users, primarily in Asia. The government said that Blude and dozens of other apps for LGBT people violate Indonesia's pornography laws. A Google spokesperson told reporters that, "We adhere to applicable local law in the countries in which we operate." The government has already blocked access to the Google Play Store website. Blude is still available for download from the country's Apple Store, at least for now. A spokesperson for Human Rights Watch, assessing the current situation for sexual and gender-variant minorities in Indonesia, warned that Sharia supremacist groups now dominate the political discourse.
But in better news from Southeast Asia, an estimated 6,000 people celebrated at the first ever public LGBT Pride event in Myanmar's capital city of Yangon. The An Proud Festival has been held for the past few years as a private event at the French Institute, and it's generally been limited to screenings of queer-themed films with an average total attendance of 2,000 to 3,000 people. This year's celebration, which more than doubled that number on its first day, got somewhat unexpected approval from the government to go public. Festivities, which were held over two consecutive weekends, kicked off on January 28th with live performances, drag queen races, and a handbag throwing contest, film screenings, and what was called a human library. Perhaps the most popular part of the day because it allowed LGBTQ people to share their life experiences in a public but supportive setting. Queer communities in Myanmar exist in the shadows of a very traditional and conservative society. Activists say many remain isolated and deeply closeted because the media generally depicts sexual and gender variant people with only ridicule and disdain. Like many other former British colonies, such as India, Myanmar still maintains its very own Penal Code Section 377, which outlaws sexual acts against the order of nature. Flushed with success, festival organizers say they're going to hold similar events in other parts of the country and begin a campaign to overturn Section 377.
But police dispersed an attempted pride gathering in the Tunisian capital of Tunis on January 27th. The Interior Ministry had banned the event for their own security and to preserve public order. The group behind the demonstration, the Association of Free Thinkers, said it was a rallying call to Sayabni, let me be, in Arabic. Officials claimed to have received advance information that the event had been targeted for violence. A few activists tried to unfurl a rainbow flag anyway and scuffled with plainclothes officers before being bundled into a police van and spirited away. Bouded Bahadi, general manager of the LGBT web broadcaster Shamsrad, told Agence France-Presse that the police roughed him up in the process. He and several staff members have been frequent targets of death threats since the pioneering queer online radio station went live late last year. Tunisia's ironically named human rights minister, Samir Dalou, has condemned the country's only queer publication, Gay Day, saying that freedom of speech has its limits. Tunisia has, at times, allowed for demonstrations critical of government policy, a media release from Human Rights Watch noted. But the LGBT rights demonstration, following a range of police abuses during protests in early January over the adoption of austerity measures, the statement worries, raises questions about the depth of Tunisia's commitment to the fundamental right to peaceful protest. Same-gender sex is a crime in Tunisia, punishable by up to 3 years in prison.
But even government officials in what many call the most homophobic nation on earth, Jamaica, know that a line needs to be drawn somewhere. The Ministry of National Security this week stopped rabidly homophobic U.S. preacher Stephen Anderson from boarding a flight to the Caribbean island because his often inflammatory statements are not conducive to the current climate. The University of the West Indies in Kingston, where Anderson was scheduled to speak, also rescinded its invitation. Stephen Anderson leads the Faithful Word Baptist Church in Tempe, Arizona, and is notorious for his public pronouncements denying the Holocaust and calling for gay people to be stoned to death. His push for such gruesome executions during an interview in September 2016 on a radio station in Botswana got him kicked out of that country. He's already been banned from South Africa, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Anderson outraged most civilized people in a viral video in June 2016 by celebrating the murderous Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida, by telling his parishioners that there were now 50 less pedophiles in the world. An online change.org petition signed by close to 39,000 people persuaded the Jamaican government to withdraw its welcome mat. Anderson told the Jamaica Gleaner newspaper that he was a bit surprised by the ban based on his understanding of the island's well-established anti-LGBT laws and societal attitudes. He vowed to take his mission to another more welcoming, though unnamed, Caribbean country.
El Salvador's Supreme Court rejected a proposal by lawmakers this week to constitutionally define marriage as between one man and one woman who were each born that way. It would also have prevented same-gender couples from adopting children. The Central American country's high court criticized how the measure was rushed through the Legislative Assembly during the waning days of the session with no chance for public comment. The ruling, however, also comes on the heels of a decision by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in January that requires the nations that have signed on to the American Convention on Human Rights to open marriage to same-gender couples. El Salvador is one of those countries. a number of other signatories are wrestling with the issue. Marriage equality has caused sharp divides in the usually laid-back presidential election campaign in Costa Rica. The leading contender, evangelical Christian singer and congressman Fabricio Alvarado, has railed against the Inter-American Court's ruling.
And finally, everyone wondered if one of Australia's leading voices against marriage equality, right-wing former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, would attend, perhaps even dance at, the wedding of his out-and-proud lesbian sister and Sydney City Councillor Christine Forster after the institution was opened to same-gender couples earlier this year. Abbott and his wife were in the front row and all smiles when Forster wed longtime partner Virginia Flitcroft, a hospital administrator, in a civil ceremony overlooking the Sydney Opera House on February 2nd. Cabaret performer Bob Down serenaded the pair with the song Love is in the Air during their bridal waltz. We don't know if Brother Tony danced, but the former Roman Catholic seminarian said that he was looking forward to having a new sister-in-law in the family.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 3rd, 2018, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
One of the best-kept secrets of the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras is its program of events focusing on Indigenous LGBTIQ Australians. All the world has heard about the massive Mardi Gras parade and the star-studded after-party. Fair Day and the Film, Theatre, Art and Queer Thinking Fest are also well-known. But then there's Koori Gras. Koori is an Australian English word for Aboriginal people from the southeast of the country. What began at the third Mardi Gras in 1980 with the first group to march under the banner Black Gays has grown into Koori Gras. This Way Out Sydney correspondent Barry McKay has a preview of this year's events, illustrated with some of last year's colourful performances.
Koori Gras in Sydney this year will feature a series of creative development workshops for First Peoples queer performers, a community forum to discuss relevant issues and challenges for First Peoples communities, a speakers platform where an international panel of influential thinkers and artists come together to discuss queer performance from First Peoples perspectives. And showtime will be the Black Nulla Cabaret held in Redfern, the traditional heart of Sydney's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, which showcases Australian Indigenous queer performers with special international guests this year.
So without much further ado, ladies and gentlemen, she's one of our favourites. You all know her. Please, make some noise for Nana Miss Koori!
Aboriginal drag queen Nana Miss Koori will be hosting the event this year.
Being Nana Miss Koori, it's about expressing myself. I love being on stage and, presenting myself as a drag queen. It gives me the ability to actually be myself, to express myself. You know, I'm still myself, but up until that wig goes on, I get into a professional persona, which is so much fun. Yeah, it's not going to stop here. I'll be going for quite some time yet.
What is unique about being an Aboriginal drag queen?
My costumes I like to identify my costumes through my culture and also with my look, my appearance, my makeup, and just the way that I carry myself on stage. Nana Miskori can be quite cheeky at times, with due respect. She knows when to pull back from performing, but you know, little antic that I do have is sitting on some people's laps in parts of a particular song. I love country music. I love the likes of Whitney Houston. There's some Marsha Hines music that I perform to. A real Australian icon. So I do a mixture of performance to music.
Two up-and-coming cheeky and talented Aboriginal drag queens to watch out for in Sydney this year are the Dreamtime Divas, Lazy Dunaman and No Vagina.
Now, welcome to the stage, Miss No Vagina!
So who's going to be performing this year at Coup de Grâce 2018?
That's a little bit of a surprise, but obviously, being co-curator, I've actually made a spot for myself as Nana Miskori. There is the Dreamtime Divas. They're longtime friends of mine that will be performing, and they've really been successful in their career.
And they're fabulous, aren't they?
They are fabulous, and they're so glitz and glamour,
Wonderful costumes, aren't they?
Amazing costumes. So it's a bit of a competition for me to try and match mine to theirs. But my dear sister Destiny has arrived. She'll be performing. She's fresh from, performing with myself at Heaps Gay event over in Marrickville in front of about 1,500, 1,800 people at a street party.
You've got some performers coming from overseas this year, haven't you?
Yeah, we have an international performer, artist, which is on the quiet at the moment. I can't disclose, but is another Indigenous person.
From Canada?
From Canada, yes. I can say that. And then we've also got some people from, from the First Nations, which they had their first competition in Darwin. So we'll have some people come along and perform for us there. So for the likes of people that weren't able to get to the very first ever First Nations competition up in Darwin, Northern Territory, we'll have a few of them at hand, which we will actually have.
Make some noise for Lacey Dunaman!
Do you have a lot of non-Indigenous people that come along to the Coup de Grâce?
Amazing following. A lot of mainstream, there is a lot of non-Indigenous that does support, that come to our events, and which is beautiful because it's for everybody. When you're talking about equality, equality is for everyone.
So you're striving really to bring reconciliation?
Pretty much that, yeah, that, that we can all walk the same path together on our journey, on our spiritual journey.
LGBTI, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander folk getting organised, showing culture and really coming out of the closet and being supported by white allies. So it's really good. I mean, the thing is that Aboriginal folk are suffering higher and higher imprisonment rates. They're suffering land grabs by state and federal governments who support the state governments, and also massive child removal. So, and this, of course, affects the LGBTI community within the Aboriginal crew, but so these are some of the issues as well, though, coming out of the closet, facing racism and homophobia. We've got to show a lot of support for our Aboriginal friends here.
Last year, a special guest at Coup de Grâce was Aboriginal comedian Sherilee Hood.
That's what I say, woman, heck, why aren't gay and lesbian and transgender people allowed to get married? Yeah.
You know, they tried legally for many years, but we fought it. You know, never stopped us breeding, but and we're fucking good at that. You know, we're good breeders, man. This year is about equality. You know, and we have got our equal rights. And it's about loving and sharing together. You know, and it is. I mean, I'm hetero, you know. Nothing wrong with that, eh? But fucking hell, I love that you as a family, as blooming, just let all the love out here, and I can feel it. So for these 2 weeks, man, I'm gay, yes.
I asked Sherilee what inspires her comedy.
I think it's about expressing yourself and finding the deeper humour in all the tragedy that happens around the place. And one thing that I always stand up for is I think justice is a major issue. So I love to talk about lots of different things, and I think part of the original Australian community really have to put up with a lot of different prejudice and racism. And I think it's important for everybody to be able to have a voice. And that's why I always speak for myself and, like, different issues and everybody going through injustice. It's been brilliant being a part of the gay and lesbian transgender community for this 2017. And I think it's really important for everybody just to accept people for who they are rather than judges. Life isn't made up, or a garden isn't made up of one flower. It's made up of many different flowers, beautiful colours and many original and unique qualities about different flowers. And we are flowers in God's garden, and I don't think we should be, you know, judging different flowers without having meaning behind it. So I'm one black flower who's always going to stand up in a lot of different communities to make sure that everybody has the equal rights that they deserve. We are the human race.
Brr. I also spoke to some of the attendees on how they felt the evening went.
I'm definitely having an awesome night here tonight. I'm a Sydney resident. I live out in Western Sydney, so it's definitely awesome coming into the city for Coorie Gras.
How is this special to other Mardi Gras events you've been to?
Well, it's awesome because I don't feel like there's much black representation in Mardi Gras, so it's amazing to have an event like this go on during the week. This was set up as a space for black fellas coming into Sydney for Mardi Gras this week. It was set up as a communal space so we can just chill out, hang out. Each night they've had awesome events going on. Tonight's Black Nulla, and there's been an awesome array of black drag queens coming on. I feel very inspired. I'm an artist, you know, and I feel like I'm just getting out and hanging with my people. So Mardi Gras is like Christmas to me, so yeah.
Look, it was a huge success. It was so great to be amongst the community here in Redfern, and, you know, just to be amongst all of our LGBTIQ community, and particularly the brother boys and sister girls, you know, like it's so great that we can have a safe space like this to come and celebrate. And I think it's really important that this happens before the Mardi Gras parade, so we actually have a special event before it all happens.
I'm a Moomba woman. I'm from what you call the great northern lands of Broome. I'm a weirdo Yandu, a strong magic woman. It's all in what you want to do. This song is called Kojara. This is about us growing up now, coming together. Good to see your family. Haven't seen you for a while. Rise to lightning spirit. Get up, stand up. Let's get on with it. One circle. Kojara, Kojara, Inja Kojara, Yai Kojara, Kojara. Kojara, Kojara, Inja Kojara, Yai Kojara, Kojara. Once we come together.
The beautiful voice of Kerri-Ann Cox, an Indigenous singer who sang at the opening of last year's Boomalley Gallery LGBTIQ Indigenous Art Exhibition. The gallery in Sydney's Leichhardt will be staging another Indigenous LGBTIQ art exhibition this year. I spoke to the curator of the gallery, Kyra Kum Singh.
This year we've called our exhibition Luscious All Sorts. The theme is Love One. It's around the 2017 equality, marriage equality stuff, and we decided to do our own little spin on it, and I thought it'd be great for all the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists around to do art pieces around love and all that sort of stuff. So I think it was really timing for that decision to come through last year, and I think for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we've never really been equal in this country. However, one step at a time, and we'll slowly get there, I guess. So,
who's going to be performing this year?
So, opening the exhibition, we've got Casey Conway. He is an advocate of Indigenous LGBTQI issues. Performing, we've got the Dreamtime Divas, Destiny Has Arrived, and also Dawn Daylight. And also on the decks and emceeing the night is DJ Nayan. Yeah, we've got a good little lineup of performers for the opening night.
So we're all going to have a lot of fun on opening night.
Yes, definitely. So, yeah. I mean, it's all about making sure that we get supported and have a space to be able to celebrate 40 years of the Mardi Gras, as well as 30 years of existence for Bumali Aboriginal Artist Cooperative as well.
Koori Gras runs from the 19th to the 24th of February, with the Black Nulla Cabaret on the closing night, Saturday the 24th. The opening of the Bumali Art Gallery Luscious All Sorts Love One exhibition will be on Friday the 23rd of February. Check them out on Facebook or search for them at mardigras.org.au. If you'd like to see videos of the performances from last year's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander celebrations during Sydney's Lesbian and Gay Mardi Gras, just head to the This Way Out webpage at thiswayout.org. With thanks to Mugulan Arts and the Bumali Aboriginal Art Gallery in Sydney, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, getting ready for this year's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Koori Gras during Sydney's Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and Jessica Andrea, produced by Steve Pride, and from Barry McKay. Aretha Franklin and Annie Lennox, Whitney Houston and Carrie Ann Cox performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2SER Sydney, New South Wales, WXOJ Northampton, Massachusetts, KUNR Reno, Nevada, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Today, we've got three talks on three important topics to share with you. One is about North Korea and its political economic development over time and what that means for the effect that sanctions are likely to have. The second talk we'll present is on the relationship between torture and the law, and the third examines neoliberal attacks on education. Later this hour, you'll hear Chela Delgado, an Oakland-based educator and activist, talk about charter schools and school, quote, choice, and what's happening to students and especially students of color. You'll also hear UC Santa Barbara sociologist Lisa Hajar discuss the right not to be tortured and the pursuit of accountability, of holding torturers and their enablers accountable. We begin with Kevin Gray, who is a lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex in the UK and a visiting fellow at the Wilson Center. Gray is the author of Korean Workers and Neoliberal Globalization and Labor and Development in East Asia. Here's Kevin Gray speaking at an event about averting U.S. war on North Korea. The event, put on by the Center for Political Education, was held in Oakland last November 10th.
I'm going to step back a little bit and try to give an overview of the course of North Korean development over the period of North Korea's existence, because I think in the media we think of North Korea basically as this kind of launching pad for missiles and all this kind of thing, but of course, as we heard, it's the home of 25 million people. The question of economic development, of course, tells us a lot about the quality of life and the livelihood of those people, but it also tells us a great deal about how particular policies such as sanctions and how they may or may not work and through what specific economic and political mechanisms they may work. Now, I think one of the great puzzles of North Korea is that if you go back to the 1960s, British economist Joan Robinson visited North Korea in the 60s and labelled North Korea as a miracle economy, which of course is a term that we later used to talk about South Korea and Taiwan. But it was at that time, after Japan, the most industrialized country in Asia. Of course, things changed. More recently, North Korea, one Japanese economist refers to it as the poorest advanced economy in the world, which is a kind of paradoxical kind of term to refer to it, but it relates to the fact that, of course, after the famine and the economic crisis, that living standards declined a great deal, but at the same time, it's a country which is, high technology. It has the ability to develop missiles and has a nuclear program. And this paradox is something that I'd like to explore a little bit, because I think it's very much related to, in some ways, the specificity of North Korea's existence as a state, okay? Because the way I analyze this is that North Korea is a particular product of what many, starting with Trotsky, called the uneven and combined development of global capitalism, which leads to specific instances of late industrializing countries which use the state to try to develop the country as fast as possible to be able to deal with external geopolitical pressures. So North Korea is this kind of combination of quite different kind of characteristics. Of course, on the one hand, it is based on the Soviet model. Going back to the 1945, the division of the Korean Peninsula, it is the case that Kim Il-sung and his Manchurian guerrillas were supported by the Soviet state. But unlike many of the other state socialist economies in the world, North Korea was also a post-colonial state with a strong kind of anti-imperialist orientation and a form of developmental nationalism which underpinned many of its policies. So there was this kind of quite unique combination. And also, when we think about the Korean Peninsula, it is one of the key sites of geopolitical conflict in the world. I mean, it always has been. This goes back to the 16th century and the competition between Japan and China. So, and this has continued right until the present day. So this extraordinary strong drive as a result of geopolitical factors shaped the North Korean system a great deal. So as I say, in many ways it copied a lot of the Soviet institutions, but it took those even further. So collectivization of agriculture, it was ideological in a certain sense, but it was also a way of facilitating the transfer of resources from the countryside into industry. North Korea was able to industrialize very, very rapidly, so unlike China and Vietnam, very quickly North Korea became an industrialized and urbanized society. It eliminated the market to a much greater degree than nearly all the other state socialist economies. So after the Korean War, ordinary North Korean people would get most of their daily necessities and their food through a kind of rationing system. And the Soviet Union, the rationing system was put in place at particular times, but only in times of crisis. In North Korea, it became a kind of a permanent feature of the system. And so, as I say, I mean, this is very much about its extremely precarious existence as a state. So in the 60s, in particular, you had the rise of South Korea. You also had kind of the Sino-Soviet split, which created North Korean, accentuated North Korean anxieties about its external relationships. So from very early on in its existence, it invested a huge amount of its resources in heavy industrialization for the purposes of building up a defense industry, which they saw as being essential to securing their own existence as a state. Now, that took a huge toll on the economy. So when Joan Robinson went to North Korea in the 60s and called it a miracle economy, there are already cracks emerging in the economy because of the incredible burden of defense spending, and the seventh year plan in the 60s had to be postponed. They started to struggle to meet their goals. And in addition to that, you had all the issues that many of the state socialist economies had in the sense that they made investments, but there was no process of this kind of capitalist creative destruction that would lead to the continuous reinvestment of surplus value into production. So In the 70s, you had detente, and North Korea, like many of the state socialist countries, took advantage of that and started to trade with the West and started to import new technologies from Western European countries, from Japan, run up huge levels of debt trying to do that to keep its economy going. North Korea had a particular problem because it was, to pay for these imports, it was dependent on exporting raw materials, and like many third world countries, suffered from the collapse of raw material prices in the 1970s and was not able to pay that back. And of course, North Korea was not a member of the IMF. It was, I mean, you could say this was a good thing for them, given what happened to them and the other third world countries, but they were not able to get a bailout. And what happened was their credit rating just disappeared. They were no longer able to borrow. They became increasingly dependent on support from the Soviet Union and China. And of course, the end of the Cold War is the point that the Soviet Union and China, almost at the same time, 1990, 1991, said that we're not going to supply friendship prices for energy imports. And North Korea, being an extremely energy-dependent country due to its high level of industrialization, including its agriculture, suffered an economic crisis. And this was combined with climatic events, terrible floods in the mid-1990s. And the collapse of this public distribution system, the system whereby North Koreans depended upon for all their food and all their goods. So this led to the massive famine of the 1990s, reportedly up to a million or so people died in that famine due to the contradictions in their model of political economy that had emerged as a result, I would say, of their geopolitical context. So that's the context of the crisis. But what I want to talk about also is what's happened after then, because this tells us a lot about contemporary trends and how they may be affected by sanctions. So the biggest socioeconomic change in North Korea that's happened in the past 20 to 30 years is basically an end to the centrally planned system. So what's happened is you have a transition towards the market. Some may call it capitalism, depending on what your definition of capitalism. If you're of a certain strand of the left, you may have always called it capitalism, called it a state capitalist country. But what's happened is you've had the rise of the market. People now depend on market forces for their daily livelihoods, and what's left of the centrally planned system is very minimal. So people started to grow their own food. They would set up sometimes illegal plots in the cities, and they would clear land in the mountains and grow their own food. They also, many farmers had their own plots anyway, so these became much more important. In terms of daily goods, you saw the expansion of trade between North Korea and China, so China started to supply the kind of daily goods that people needed for their everyday life. So this emergence of the market, in some sense, provided a safety net for people who had suddenly lost access to the centrally planned system. But also, with the rise of the market, you also get all the other sort of negative effects of that, increasing inequality within North Korea as well. So these kind of socioeconomic changes. And of course, with the rise of the market, you have the rise of a sort of entrepreneurial, you may say capitalist class within North Korea that's coming from the grassroots. Okay, so this is a very profound change in the nature of North Korean society over the past 20 years. The other question then is how the state has responded to this within North Korea. So the North Korean state obviously does not like to admit that this is what has happened. There's a kind of pretense that there's still a state socialist system, and the legal system within North Korea still kind of speaks to this. And the reality of the market and the de jure kind of legal system centered around the state socialist economy, the gaps are sort of papered over with corruption. Now, corruption is often thought of extremely negatively, but it's also a way in North Korea that people are able to actually get what they need through payments to particular connected individuals and things like that. So the state, you know, the North Korean state is very critical of what China did in the 1980s. They don't like to talk about reform. Reform is kind of a dirty word in North Korea, but they have an alternative to it, which is just improvement measures. And so they do talk about this. So even before the crisis in the 1980s, there were efforts to try to attract foreign direct investment. After the crisis in the early 2000s, there were certain reforms that actually accepted a degree of the reality of the role of the market. So bringing state-controlled prices to market levels, liberalization of decision-making within corporations, a more realistic exchange rate, and these kind of things. So the context of this, of course, is the market. Now in North Korea, there are official markets. They're no longer black markets. So there are around 400 officially established general marketplaces in the country where people generally get their daily goods from. So this trend signifies that the state in North Korea has become less powerful over time. It's still, as you say, it's an authoritarian state, but it does not have that hold over people that it once did, because people have now got their own ways of securing their livelihood. They're less dependent on the state. The state's attitude to the markets has shifted and gone a bit backwards and forwards over time. So in the last years of the Kim Jong-il government, there was a currency reform where the state tried to confiscate the newfound wealth of the entrepreneurial class. But that reform was something of a disaster because it assumed that by confiscating the wealth of the entrepreneurial class, it would be able to re-establish the public distribution system. But that failed, and people suddenly found that they had nowhere that they could get their daily goods. And by most reports, actually, the markets did remain open because local bureaucrats simply ignored the instructions they were getting from the central Pyongyang government. So that reform actually failed, and I think it shows the irreversibility of marketization within North Korea. And under the Kim Jong-un government, there's pretty much been a consistent market-friendly policy. So the Kim Jong-un government, since 2011, has generally accepted the market, partly because the state's dependent on income from the market increasingly, but also there's been further reforms in agriculture and industry to introduce kind of market principles there. And if you look at the North Korean media these days, there's less of a concern with the military as there was under Kim Jong-il. It's more about the objective of increasing people's livelihoods. So Kim Jong-un is usually visiting a fish farm or an orchard or a food factory or these kind of things, or some kind of leisure facility, whereas with his father, Kim Jong-il, it tended to be visiting the Navy or the Air Force or that kind of thing. So those are the trends. The question then is, given sanctions, what effect is this likely to have? Now, in the past 10 years, for the most part, sanctions have really been, at least UN sanctions, have been somewhat limited. They're what they call smart sanctions, where they try to target the leadership, they try to target particular goods that make support the nuclear program. But over the past year, the sanctions have suddenly increased in scope. So in the sanctions that were passed in September this year, they explicitly target the textile industry and the export of fuel into North Korea. And also it targets North Korean workers working abroad. Now, all of those things then are sort of features or causes or results of the marketization of the economy. And I think, you know, this kind of raises questions then about whether we can take seriously this paragraph within the sanctions resolutions that say that the sanctions are not directed at ordinary people. So it seems somewhat paradoxical that the sanctions are actually have the potential to undermine the process of marketization within North Korea by targeting the sort of people's economy, if you like. And more generally, I think with sanctions, we need to sort of consider how likely they are to work. If you think about successful instances of sanctions, for example, against South Africa, for example, they worked by exploiting particular cleavages within elites. And of course, within South Africa, there was a strong anti-apartheid movement. But what you see in North Korea is actually very limited development of civil society despite these changes. I mean, the lack of development of civil society that may be emboldened or strengthened by sanctions, but also even between the elites themselves. I don't think anybody's ever identified any kind of difference of opinion or splits within the North Korean elite about the question of nuclear weapons, because as with, you know, when you look at what happened to Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, the North Koreans know this, they're fully aware of this, and they know what happens when you give up your nuclear weapons and sign a deal with the United States. So they're probably much more committed now, even than they are in the 1990s, for nuclear weapons. So all these issues, lack of civil society and the lack of cleavages within the regime that can be exploited by sanctions, it seems that the main outcome of sanctions will be this humanitarian impact. Now, of course, sanctions supporters may justify a humanitarian impact of those policies in the sense that a degree of economic pain may bring about change. But if we have an objective understanding of the state of state-society relations and the nature of the elite in North Korea, it seems that probably what's more likely is that not only will these sanctions undermine the process of marketization, which has led to a certain degree of the increase in living standards in North Korea, but it will also just lead to a similar situation to what you had with Iraq, where sanctions in Iraq actually in some way served to strengthen the Iraqi state's hold over the population due to forms of rationing and these kind of things that were introduced. But also, of course, we have the terrible humanitarian consequence of sanctions in Iraq, where you had reportedly up to 500,000 children had died. So hopefully that provides a bit of overview of the main changes within North Korea that's happened in recent years, but also about how, given those changes, the current dominant approach towards North Korea, which is sanctions, may actually have counterproductive effects from the perspective of the senders of those sanctions.
That's Kevin Gray. He's a lecturer in international relations at the School of Global Studies at the University of Sussex, and he's published widely on various aspects of East Asian political economy. I want to thank the Center for Political Education for providing us with the audio. CPE, which sponsored the event last November, in which Kevin Gray participated, is a San Francisco-based resource for political organizations on the left, progressive social movements, the working class, and people of color. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We turn next to Lisa Hajar, a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Her books include Courting Conflict, The Israeli Military Court System in the West Bank and Gaza, and Torture, A Sociology of Violence and Human Rights. She spoke at a forum entitled The Moral and Political Obligation to Resist Torture Post-9/11 to the Present, held at the University of Washington School of Law in Seattle on September 26th of last year. Here's Lisa Hajar.
I wanted to start, you know, because so much of our thinking about torture is very much centered on the post-9/11 era and the debates that have gone on. But I just want to, just as a starting point, just really talk for a moment about what is the importance of torture in a much broader, much deeper historical perspective. I mean, the relationship between torture and the law. You know, torture was in much of Western, Europe, was legal and necessary in the law. And it was only at a particular moment, kind of one of those enlightenment moments, when torture, the law of torture was changed in order to prevent what had previously been deemed legal and necessary. And three elements of that cleansing of the law of the right to torture are absolutely elemental to three things that are crucial to modern civilizations. One is simply the rule of law itself. You know, the rule of law as we understand it is literally built, the cornerstone of the rule of law is the cleansing of the law of the right to perpetrate violence against people in custody. The second important element of this history of torture is that once it was written out of the law, by limiting what states or governments can do to people when they're at their most vulnerable, imposing legal limits on states was a major phenomenon in modern legal liberalism. And the third element is by preventing torture, by saying that it's not okay to purposely harm people in custody, it was literally one of the first steps to turn people into humans, to turn people into humans who have inviolable rights. And I've always, you know, sort of said, back when I was doing torture, before all the rest of you people were doing torture, was that it really is the most important and the most universal human right that we have. All human rights are important, but what is so significant about the right not to be tortured is that it is an absolute right. It applies to all people everywhere under all circumstances. You don't have to be a good person to have the right not to be tortured. You just have to be a person. And so that significance of the right not to be tortured in its relationship to the rule of law, its relationship to the limits on the powers of the state, is absolutely essential. And so violating that right doesn't just harm the victims. You know, it literally harms the law. It harms civilization. It harms the principles of humanity. I mean, it degrades many of the things that we thought we might be, you know, sort of, especially in this country, the champions of. And I would also just mention that torture, in its context in the law, if we now fast forward to the 20th century and the 21st century, torture's partners in the law are genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. So when people in this country blithely, you know, excuse or justify or embrace or applaud torture, it behooves us to remember that they could be literally behooving genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, because all four of those specific categories are the, what are called gross violations under international law. And they are all absolutely and categorically prohibited by the law. And so it just, you know, the prohibition of torture is, and its criminality, are customary international law. So if every human being everywhere on earth has a right not to be tortured legally, that means there's absolutely no human being on earth has a right to torture. And anyone who is engaged in or abetted torture is and should be made vulnerable to the law. The law should be, you know, we should be on the side of the law that wants to prosecute people. I mean, you know, and that's an essential element. So I just want to note for a moment the, you know, thinking about what the law does in this context. We're thinking about torture as a crime. Sometimes I like to cite the work of the late Robert Cover, who was a law professor and philosopher at Yale. And he was the guy who really gave, created in a sense in the 1980s and 90s, an appreciation for the violence of law. And he's, you know, he's been credited for ushering in and laying the ground for what was, what's been termed like a jurisprudence of violence. And one of his famous quotes was, "Legal interpretation takes place on a field of pain and death." He was talking about the violence of the law, law enforcement. But when I, when we're thinking about these kinds of gross human rights violations, I'm a strong enthusiast for the violence of the law when it comes to the prosecution of people who are accused of gross violations of the of human rights and international law. And in that sense, you know, I sort of sometimes stand outside the narrative of many of my progressive friends, intellectuals, and others who are, you know, devoted to politically politically committed to progressive causes and protecting rights. But many progressives are fundamentally uncomfortable with violence and even legal violence, and they want to see themselves and their cause as rejoinders to violence. And that's a good thing. But I believe that Robert Covered was right. The law is violent, even if that violence is antiseptically termed legitimate force. And so I see a progressive cause. Maybe it's not everybody's cup of tea, but everybody, you know, it is, there's a progressive cause in developing a, what I call a perpetrator-centered perspective, like looking for perpetrators and looking to do legal violence to them. So not sort of get your violence on. I mean, I'm, you know, big enthusiast for that kind of thinking in terms of when it comes to prosecuting agents of the state and other officials who engage in torture, war crimes, crimes against humanity, etc. Now, there are a number of ways in which accountability can be pursued. And as the ACLU who representative who very eloquently talked about the many doors that have been closed on accountability in this country until the precedential civil case of Jessenyi Mitchell. But if we think more broadly, I mean, torture is an international crime. And among the ways in which people who can be, there's no statute of limitations citations for the crime of torture. And so if you think about how do you get these guys, you know, some of them are still young. Some of them are still out there. Some of them are still teaching law at Berkeley. There are ways of thinking about this, you know. So one of the, obviously the violations of the Geneva Conventions, you know, torture is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. Therefore, it's a war crime. Now, the law itself, what happened in the United States after 9/11 was that with the advisement of right-wing lawyers cooperating with political officials who felt they deluded themselves into thinking that torture was a necessary and legitimate strategy. They offered up legal reasonings, including, for example, President Bush on February 7th, 2002, was heavily advised by these lawyers and by Dick Cheney to declare the Geneva Conventions inapplicable to the war on terror. And this primary purpose of that declaration was to shield officials from the prospect of future prosecutions. And as we know what happened, you know, fast forward to Obama, Obama never pursued accountability on the grounds that the law in this country had been so tainted by these ridiculous, contrary to rationality interpretations, but nevertheless, they were official interpretations, and it makes it very difficult to prosecute people in this country, particularly government officials. But there is, you know, one thing we could say is that the doctrine of universal jurisdiction, that remains a relevant criminal international law doctrine. And it's the one, what the universal jurisdiction means is that some crimes are so extreme that their perpetrators are enemies of all mankind. That's what it is. And so in the contemporary era, torturers, war criminals, genocidaires, and those responsible for crimes against humanity are enemies of all mankind because those crimes are regarded as menacing humanity itself. And what that means is that if a person is not prosecuted in his or her own jurisdiction, he or she can be prosecuted anywhere in the world. And so the cases that have been pursued, although so far unsuccessfully for the most part in Europe, have operationalized the universal jurisdiction doctrine. But the Obama administration, very much thwarted the possibility for justice in European courts. But because there is no statute of limitations, it's still possible to get these people, you know. And I mean, I would say that one of the things we can learn from the example of Latin America, where, you know, during the dirty wars, you know, horrific crimes were perpetrated. And then there was, for the most part, immunity for about 20 years. Two things that mattered then and now was that the fact that there were, I mean, really, human rights activism began, as we now think of it, in Latin America, in South Africa, in the occupied Palestinian territories, in the places where governments were perpetrating some of the worst violence. And those human rights activists who took positions in the 1970s against human rights violations and made the use of international law, they were the first people who brought international law down to the streets and out into the sort of public domain, didn't really have much of an effect in Latin America, but time passes. And as we know, you know, over time, it was the fact that human rights activists had taken note and documented and protested back in the 70s and 80s, and the passage of time and the possibility of then in the 90s and 2000s going after those aging military dictators and torturers from Latin America. So even if people are feeling depressed about what has happened or the possibilities of justice now, you know, just remember that the work that people are doing now, the organizations, this will be important in the future, I think. So I would just sort of conclude with just a couple of things about the issue of domestic unaccountability. I mean, not prosecuting torturers makes a mockery of the law itself. And that's something that, you know, as we have our partisan debates and as 72% of Republicans, when polled, are now support torture and whatever the kinds of debates, they've become so void of both the deeper significance historically and legally. And they're really just a partisan issue. You know, I mean, it's really sort of minimized these issues. points. But it's important for, you know, people like us and people who we come in contact with to really keep on pressing the point of accountability. And as John Kiriakou had mentioned, I mean, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which is inaccessible to us, you know, but for the heavily redacted executive summary, it contains our nation's history. You know, it contains our nation's history. And the fact that some people, you know, in Congress would have wanted to destroy every copy is disgusting. You're destroying our history. It's a disgusting chapter of our history, but it's our history. But then Obama saved our history, albeit in the most namby-pamby way possible. He preserved one copy of this document of our grotesque history of torture in his presidential archives, but he said nobody can access it for the longest amount of time, you know, available by law. But the point is that we have to keep on understanding, even from the information that we have, what this country did, and that accountability is important and, you know, something to continue being activists about. I mean, the little we know, I mean, we know a lot from the executive summary, but one of the things we know, you know, is that aside from just torture, I mean, torture is almost, as I've sort of suggested, it's become so commonplace in American, you know, vernacular. But it was also involved human experimentation. So it's important to invoke that term. Like, the CIA engaged in human experimentation. And if that brings to mind Nazis, that's exactly the point. By shielding, you know, CIA officials from the rules and norms of law that were established because of the Nazis, we are back, you know, in a place where this is something our history resembles a Nazi history, you know, and it disregards the safety mechanisms that were instituted after the Holocaust about not being able to experiment on human beings. And so, you know, information, you know, becomes absolutely crucial. I want to, you know, sort of commend, you know, in terms of bringing to the public the attention of these issues, obviously John Kiriakou, obviously Chelsea Manning, and other people who have helped the public see what the government does not want us to see, which is, you know, information about crimes, right? This is information about crimes, and the criminality of it is something that it's worth keeping in mind. So I would just say the history of this era that we're living in, it's defined both by torture and by transnational efforts anti-torture efforts to stop and punishment. And so even failed efforts to pursue accountability now, they leave a noble record of efforts to enforce the law and validate the norms and rules that were so flagrantly violated. And these initiatives, I believe, will be important in the future, perhaps even more than in the present, because they stand as a record of resistance to dehumanization. And as any good student of law knows, law in action knows, the impact of legal initiatives can never be judged by the immediate outcome of cases.
That's Lisa Hajar, a sociologist based at UC Santa Barbara. After that presentation, there was an audience Q&A period, and here are two answers that she gave. The first was to a question about how George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump compare on the issue of torture. In the second answer, Lisa Hajar elaborates on what she means by a perpetrator-centered perspective on torture.
So Bush authorized it, Obama stopped it, and then engaged in targeted killing. When it became too costly to torture people, we, like, shifted. So if interrogation detention was the cornerstone of counterterrorism policy during the Bush years, as a result of, like, some of the fights against it and the litigation, et cetera, torture became too politically costly. And so consequently, Obama cancels the torture program and then doesn't want to bring and wants to close Guantanamo. And so there's a direct relationship between the uptick in drone warfare and the sort of exclusion of Guantanamo and the inability to pursue a lawful detention interrogation program because of the enthusiasm that emerges in support of torture after Obama cancels it. And then with Trump, I mean, they're just like, I mean, we're not, haven't taken anybody new to Guantanamo. It's not clear that this administration has any policies whatsoever, but they certainly don't have a strategic policy policy around the question of capture and interrogation. I mean, Trump may have touted the idea of bringing back the water board, but there's no policy on capture as opposed to drone strikes. So drone strikes have actually escalated even more under Trump. Particularly where activism and scholarship come together around torture, understandably, it's often focused on victims and what happens to people when they are tortured. And that's an understandable issue. But when you're thinking about, like, why torture happens or under what circumstances it's enabled or abetted, you cannot understand that by looking at the victims. I mean, we can take account of the fact that those who were tortured in the U.S. torture program were all Muslim men, but in a sense, it's one really has to look at the kinds of understandings about expansive interpretations of executive power and national security and counterterrorism. And so, by perpetrator-centered perspective, I oftentimes mean both understanding torture. You must look at the torturers. Mm-hmm. You must look at the context within which torture happens in order to understand what's happening. And then the second meaning of it is to keep in mind that torture is a crime and stay focused on the perpetrators, finding out who they are, exposing them, pursuing them, whether domestically or internationally. So those are my two meanings about perpetrator-centered perspective.
Lisa Hajjar is a sociology professor at UC Santa Barbara. She spoke at a forum on resisting torture held in Seattle last September. I want to thank Mike McCormick and Talking Stick TV for furnishing that audio. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We turn now to Chayla Delgado. Chayla Delgado is an Oakland-based educator and activist. She is a high school teacher, and she's worked with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, Teachers for Social Justice, and other groups. She has a PhD in education from UC Berkeley. Chayla Delgado spoke about education, neoliberalism, and the charter school phenomenon at an event sponsored by the Center for Political Education on the theme of Black Reconstruction in Our Times. The event was held in San Francisco on November 19th of last year. Here's Chayla Delgado.
One, as a result of the growth of charters in our district, which are now about a third of schools in Oakland Unified. And in Oakland and the West Coast in general, charters are a much more Latino phenomenon. They tend to enroll disproportionately Latino students. On the East Coast, they're disproportionately Black. So the growth of charters has meant that students have, you know, as students have left, funding for those students has gone out of district schools, right? So the district is still trying to maintain a similar number of schools without those students and their funding, right? And so what we're facing is school closures. So the growth of charters was a factor. The second factor was overspending on central admin by our former superintendent, Anton Wilson, who was trained at the Broad Academy for Superintendents, right? And so those of you who follow this stuff, Eli Broad is a billionaire in Los Angeles who has done a lot of work to expand the growth of charters throughout California and nationally. But he has a training ground. So, and a lot of these folks that you hear about, Arne Duncan, a lot of the folks in Chicago, D.C., Philly, New Orleans, all these folks have gone through the Broad Academy. So Anquan Wilson came into Oakland talking a lot of stuff about doing work for Black students in Oakland, proceeded to spend intensely at the central level, and bounced a year and a half into his contract to go to D.C. and left us millions and millions of dollars in debt. That is now being balanced on the backs of Black and brown children. So that is the current context we're in Oakland. But a lot of this does go back to this stuff around how the achievement gap was framed. So a lot of people don't actually know the origin of the term. And when I was doing my graduate work, it actually took a really long time. Only a couple of people have written about it. It was first written about in a 1956 article in D.C., about school integration, right? So the very first stuff that begins to come out about school integration is not, of course, about the challenges of integration for Black children. No, it's about school probers told of Negro lag in learning. D.C. survey shows achievement gap, right? That was 1956. So the framing of the achievement gap first began back in the 50s. It didn't really gain traction until the late 90s and early 2000s, during the time of No Child Left Behind being passed. So at that time, we did have other frameworks arise in response. So Dr. Asa Hilliard put out the framework of the opportunity gap, which he sort of framed in contrast to the idea of the achievement gap, right? That it's not that we're not achieving, it's that we don't have opportunities to achieve. Linda Darling Hammond, a little bit later, who's a professor at Stanford, put out this notion of the educational debt. And in that, she throws it back to Reconstruction, but and talks about sort of the debt that schools owe to Black children specifically, right? And that, in this moment, there was a moment where sort of there was an opportunity to focus on structural racism and what schools owe to kids. And that moment was not really taken up, right? Because what happened was there was the reality of schools having underserved kids of color and working class kids, and neoliberal reformers sort of coming in the late 90s and early 2000s and expanding the notion of choice. So this tension of sort of like the reality of schools underserving kids of color and choice as the solution within the neoliberal framework has been there from jump, right? So if you look back to 2004, there's this interesting fight between Rob Page, who was the Secretary of Education under Bush, and Julian Bond and Kwesi Mfume, who are representing the NAACP, when they critique the emphasis on standardized testing under No Child Left Behind. Rod Page, who was also Black, who had been the superintendent in Houston at the time of the quote-unquote Houston miracle, which education folks know, basically test scores increased dramatically in Houston during his tenure. Later it was found it was all shady, he was kicking kids out of the district. But he basically, when they critiqued NCLB, he sort of came at them and said, you do not own African-American authenticity. He published this in the Wall Street Journal. He said, you do not own African-American authenticity. And further, he said, essentially, he used Bush's language of the soft bigotry of low expectations and even invoked Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. He makes like a reference to Invisible Man. But essentially, he says that the problem is low expectations for Black children, right? And that's sort of a discourse that we hear from neoliberal reformers for the next 20 years. In 2011, there was a dramatic fight between the Success Charter Network in New York and the NAACP there, who filed a lawsuit against charters expanding in New York because they were mostly being co-located with public schools in New York City. And frequently, they had, like, fancy computer labs and nicer bathrooms and, you know, different food in the cafeteria. So the NAACP filed a lawsuit claiming it was separate and unequal and wanted a moratorium on charters. Success Charter Network, which was mostly Black students, entirely white board. Eve Moskowitz, they were in the papers a couple years ago because, like, they're crazy and shady. But, just to be succinct. But they essentially set... they organized and rallied their parents, gave their kids a day off school to protest the NAACP and published things like NAACP betrays Black families, why is the NAACP selling out Black students? They planted this stuff in the media everywhere and went head to head with the NAACP in New York. So I mention those things to say this sort of this tension of the reality of where education has been lacking for Black families is a real one, but it's been sort of exploited in interesting ways by neoliberal reformers who have really managed to use the achievement gap language and discourse to point us in a direction of choice. Right, that the problem is our kids don't have enough choice, our families don't have enough choice, and so if we just gave everyone choice, then that is what we need to be able to navigate for every family. And so the interesting thing about choice, of course, is that who can navigate choice, who can really access choice. And there was like a Twitter beef with Betsy DeVos and the American Federation of Teachers this past summer in which she tweeted something about we need to invest public dollars in individual students. Right? The AFT responds and says, no, we need to invest public dollars in improving a system that will benefit all students because it is their right, right? And she like thought she caught, she was like, ha, you care more about systems than individual students, right? You just care about protecting these adults and these systems and these teachers and your bureaucracies, and that's all you care about. And actually, you know, I have not generally been a fan of the way the AFT has reckoned with stuff, but you know, they sort of, they had it right. They were like, no, actually creating equitable systems will benefit all students, right? And so it's this tension of, can we create a system that, if we design a system with equity in mind, could it in fact be a way to move us toward Black liberation? Possibly. I mean, I fully acknowledge that public schools have not been a part of that. But I think that we have this question of choice, and the way neoliberal reform has pointed us toward that has essentially been incredibly limiting in what we can imagine for all students, but in particular students of color. Schools are increasingly becoming training grounds for menial jobs. I mean, talk about training for, you know, anyway, I'll just close with one other thing, which is in Oakland, there's been this huge move toward toward the tech industry partnering with schools in Oakland. In some ways, that's very exciting. In some ways, what the jobs that kids are being training for are coding jobs, which, frankly, like anyone anywhere with any access to a cell phone can often do. They're not necessarily going to be the jobs that are going to be the leadership, the high-paying, the design-thinking jobs. And that kind of emphasis is also a direct outcome of some of this neoliberal partnership that schools are engaging in at this moment. And it lacks imagination about what we can be doing.
That's Chayla Delgado. And during the Q&A period of that event, she had this to say about neoliberalism and education.
You know, when I teach my high school students about neoliberalism, I explain it as capitalism on steroids and creating markets where there weren't any markets, right? So making money where there wasn't a place to make money. So in education, I mean, obviously that's looked like the expansion of charters, but it's also looked like for-profit companies who are making tons of money off testing. It's also looked like merit, you know, pushing merit pay for teacher initiatives. And it's looked like shifting the discourse toward talking about education as a competitive marketplace, right? So a lot of these neoliberal reformers, their sort of MO has been, you know, if you believe in the idea of capitalism, right? I mean, the marketplace is emerging to compete, to create the best product for the consumer. Therefore, if you're working to create education as the best product, people will gravitate naturally toward the best thing, right? And so their argument is that introducing competition actually makes education better, because then you have schools sort of like trying to constantly innovate. You know, obviously, like, I would argue, I imagine many people in this room would agree, capitalism has not necessarily served Black people that well. So I think that what we've seen is, you know, we've seen sort of a marketplace emerging in which the reality is that folks who are able to most effectively hustle have, to some extent, been able to take advantage of that choice, that emerging choice. But there isn't really much true innovation in the marketization of education. I mean, like, what you see is kind of like the same old pedagogy, the same old stuff. But, I mean, with an interestingly even more behaviorist tech aspect. So, like, the whole, like, you know, kids lining up outside classroom doors, the whole, like, hip slant thing, their whole jam about, they have this acronym SLANT, like, sit up, listen, pay attention, nod your head. For real. And teachers are evaluated on literally the number of kids who are following that. So I think that what we've seen, you know, people claim it's innovation. I would argue it's not innovation. The majority of the corporate charters are dialing back pedagogy. There's still a small number of, like, community charters kind of doing innovative things. But, I mean, I think we're kind of reaching an interesting moment of challenge where, like, even some of those folks, you know, and it's like, I know and dearly love, like, many folks who are working at charters in Oakland, and, like, we're really reaching a moment where it's becoming glaringly, unpleasantly clear that, like, it is having a direct harm on kids in district schools. And that's, like, a really ugly conversation that folks are coming to. So I would say the neoliberalism piece is, has been undeniable. I mean, I think the most interesting thing about it is the way corporate reformers have been able to steal the language of civil rights and claim it for their own. You have Michelle Rees talking out of her mouth about civil rights. You have Betsy DeVos talking about her mouth. I mean, all these people who are just the shadiest human beings in the world. Talking about civil rights and shutting down. And I mean, to some extent, it's because the folks who have been most strongly in defense of public education have been the unions and mostly white folks who are not acknowledging the ways in which white supremacy has always been operating in public schools. It's rough now.
That's Chayla Delgado, an Oakland-based educator and activist. She spoke in San Francisco last November at an event sponsored by the Center for Political Education. And thanks to the center for furnishing the audio, which was edited by yours truly. This is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.